Simon & Schuster Audio presents Shadow Warriors, Inside the Special Forces, by Tom Clancy, with General Carl Steiner, retired, and Tony Colt. Read by George DiCenzo.
Monday, October 7, 1985. Brigadier General Carl Steiner, the commander of the Joint Special Operations Task Force, was returning from his morning run at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, when his J-2 intelligence officer, Colonel Mike Flynn, met him at the gate. "A cruise ship has been hijacked in the Mediterranean," Flynn told him coolly, but with urgency, "and Americans are very likely on board." No other organization had the capability to recapture a ship on the high seas, and Steiner knew they would certainly be called in. And soon. Steiner was a slender man of 6 feet, with a crisp but not rigid military bearing and a comfortable, easy look. At the same time, he had always been driven by an underlying intensity and a deep competitiveness. It wasn't just that he wanted to be the best or to lead his troops to be the best. All officers want that. But that he had time and again figured out ways to make it happen. As he and Flynn hurried toward the headquarters building, Steiner was already processing the news. He knew that Flynn's sparse information was all that was then available, or else Flynn would have told him more. Even so, he had to begin initial actions based on that slender thread. Through long hours of intense planning, training, and rehearsal, Joint Special Operations Task Force, JSOTF, had developed force packages for virtually any anticipated crisis situation. These were always ready to go within a few hours, as long as there were airplanes available to haul his men. Based on the planning and rehearsals, Steiner focused on what he had to work out right away. "It's a tough target. Got to get more detailed information," he thought to himself. "We'll have a long way to go and have to get on the road as soon as possible. Must order up airlift now, and we must find out the location of the ship." As these thoughts went through his mind, he remained calm. When special forces have a job to do, the job must be done fast, accurately, and efficiently. It is likely to be extremely complex, with many lives at risk and many unknown variables. Facing these conditions, people in these units do not waste their time and effort expressing feelings. They are businesslike, always focusing on the mission at hand, looking especially for vulnerabilities that can be exploited to solve the problem in the cleanest, most complete way possible. Once he reached the headquarters, he went without pausing to the Joint Operations Center, JOC, a high-tech war room complete with computer workstations and secure communications to all JSOTF units, the Pentagon, and major commands throughout the world. There he would review the latest intelligence and learn firsthand everything anyone knew about the incident in the Mediterranean. His staff principals had already assembled, waiting for his guidance. The task force maintained its own 24-hour intelligence center, complete with watch officers, military officers, and civilians expert at picking out intelligence indicators of an impending crisis, analysts, and databases covering every known terrorist organization. Terminals connected the command with all major news networks, including Reuters and the BBC. The first indication of a developing incident often appeared as a news item. JSOTF also had its own people resident in all U.S. intelligence agencies, always looking for indicators of terrorist activities, as well as already existing information that had not seemed important to analysts in those agencies. In most cases, the headquarters learned of terrorist incidents early, and they usually had the most complete information about them. Steiner knew that all available intelligence information had already been transmitted by the staff to the units that would be involved. This also meant that all his units would have begun to ready their forces for deployment, while anticipating further guidance from him. They always made maximum use of the time available. In this business, time was a most precious asset. Before Steiner had taken this command, previous tours in the Middle East had taught him a lot about terrorists and how they operated. For instance, while he had been the chief of training for the modernization of the Saudi Arabian National Guard from 1975 to 1977, he had had a chance to take the measure of Yasser Arafat and his chief lieutenants. Along with other dignitaries from the region, the Palestinians had been invited to a graduation dinner for an officer candidate class by King Khalid and Prince Abdullah, the commander of the National Guard. Arafat's lieutenants were impressive, no doubt about it. Most of them had advanced degrees from American universities. They were all well-dressed, very sharp, well-spoken, and knowledgeable about world affairs. Arafat was obviously the leader, and clearly an intelligent and remarkable man. But the lieutenants who made things work struck Steiner as truly formidable. In years to come, that impression proved terribly accurate. Later, in 1983, Steiner was assigned to Lebanon. There he got a first-hand experience of terrorism and its effects. A U.S. ambassador had been assassinated. While he was there, more than 60 people at the American embassy, and later more than 200 United States Marines, were killed by bombs. In those days, Beirut was not only an armed camp with many hostile factions, but a place where fighting might break out anywhere at any time. No one was safe, and death was an ever-present risk, from snipers, crossfires between factions, ambushes, and indiscriminate shelling by heavy artillery and rocket fire. The shelling sometimes involved thousands of rounds, which reduced entire sections of the city to rubble in half an hour. It was not an easy assignment. Yet for Steiner, it proved to be rewarding. It offered a chance to learn lessons he could get nowhere else. You learned how to survive, or you didn't. You learned whom to trust in a life-or-death situation, and whom, by faction or religious motivation, you could not trust. You learned to think like a terrorist. The traditional function of wars is to change an existing state of affairs. In the early 1970s, a new form of warfare, or maybe a new way of practicing a very old form of warfare, emerged. State-supported terrorism. Nations that were not militarily powerful learned to use terrorist tactics to obtain objectives and concessions they could never win through diplomatic or military means. When this new form of warfare broke out, the United States quickly showed itself unprepared to cope with it. It had neither a national policy nor intelligence capabilities aimed at terrorism, nor any military forces adequately trained and prepared to respond to terrorist provocations. Although the United States was the most powerful nation in the world, its military capabilities were focused on the Soviet Union and not on something like this. In 1972, Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics were massacred by Black September terrorists. This outrage might have been avoided if German snipers had had the ability to hit the terrorists as they led the hostages across the airport runway to their getaway plane. The Israelis took this lesson to heart, and on July 4, 1976, 86 Israeli paratroopers landed at Entebbe Airport in Uganda. Their mission was to rescue the passengers from an Air France airliner hijacked 8 days earlier. In a matter of minutes, the paratroopers had rescued 95 hostages and killed 4 terrorists, though at the cost of the lives of 2 hostages and the paratroop commander. News of the raid flashed all over the world and pointed out even more sharply America's inadequacies in fighting terrorism. This truth had already been brought out in May 1975. 41 American Marines were killed in an attempt to rescue the 39 crewmen of the American merchant ship Mayaguez after it had been seized by the Cambodian government. The rescue attempt had failed. These incidents clearly indicated that the United States was unprepared to deal with terrorist-created hostage situations. To correct this shortfall in the mid-70s, 3 far-seeing people began lobbying for the creation of a special elite unit to deal with this unconventional threat. Lieutenant General Edward C. Shy Meyer, Director of Operations for the Army. Major General Robert Bob Kingston, Commander of the Army Special Forces. And Robert Kupperman, Chief Scientist for the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, who was managing the government's studies on terrorism. The 3 initially made little headway. Scant support for the elite unit could be found among the services, and even within the Army, even though it was devastatingly clear that the technology in which the Army was investing so heavily, tanks, helicopters, air defense missiles, armored personnel carriers, and all the other machinery of the modern-day battlefield, was of little use against terrorists. The opposition stemmed primarily from two sources. A bias against elite units as such, elites have never been popular in the U.S. Army, and the perception that the unit would rob resources and available funds from the existing force structure. On June 2, 1977, Lieutenant General Meyer presented the concept of this special mission unit to Army Chief of Staff General Bernard Rogers. This unit was to be the premier counter-terrorist force, because it was expected to deal with the most complex crisis situations. It would have capabilities like no other military unit. It would be organized with three operational squadrons and a support squadron, and it was to be composed of hand-picked men with demonstrated special maturity, courage, inner strength, and the physical and mental ability to react appropriately to resolve every kind of crisis situation, including imminent danger to themselves. Exactly a month later, on November 19, 1977, the Army officially activated the unit, but it took another 2 years to develop the tactics and procedures required for the unit's projected mission. The unit's final exam and validation exercise was held at Hunter Army Airfield at Fort Stewart, Georgia, and ended in the early morning hours of Sunday, November 4th. It was now certified for its special mission requirements. Ironically, just as the exercise was taking place, a mob was invading the American Embassy in Tehran. Moments later, everyone inside, 53 people, became hostages to the new religious-led Iranian Revolutionary Government. The crisis of the next 444 days challenged the United States as it had never been challenged before, and proved a horribly painful lesson in effective response to terrorist incidents. The nation was faced with risks, quandaries, contradictions, legal issues, other nations' involvement, and sovereignty issues. And there were no easy solutions. We were presented with what was in fact an act of war, yet this war was on a scale that made the use of heavy weapons either impractical or overkill. And besides, there were hostages. We wanted to do something to turn the situation to our advantage. But what? In terms of shooters and operators, the unit was probably the most capable unit of its kind in the world. But it did not yet have the necessary infrastructure to go with it. No command organization, no staff, no combat support units. To make matters more frustratingly complex, the intelligence infrastructure necessary for support of rescue operations did not exist in Iran either. Meanwhile, President Jimmy Carter, sitting very uncomfortably between a rock and a hard place, decided that an operation to rescue the 53 hostages had to be attempted. Army Special Forces had to be the centerpiece of any rescue in Iran. The obvious model was the Israeli raid on Entebbe, a brilliantly planned, led, and executed operation, yet only a marginally useful model. The difficulties of a raid into Tehran were incomparably larger. The Entebbe raid was made against an airfield. The raiders could land there quickly and make their move against the terrorists almost before they themselves had been detected. Tehran was a major metropolis with a population in the millions, and it was hundreds of miles inside a vast and hostile country. Getting inside Tehran and into the embassy undetected and with sufficient force to do any good presented many problems. Major General James Vaught was picked to head the rescue operation. He had a capable Special Forces unit, but that was all he had. He literally had to begin from scratch to create an effective headquarters for command, control, and intelligence support functions. To select and train a competent staff, develop a plan, select the support units, and train the force for the mission. If Special Forces could get to the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, they were certainly capable of conducting the rescue operation. But getting them there and back was the challenge. It meant the establishment of staging bases in countries willing to support American efforts and of a support infrastructure within Iran itself. This required first an airfield for transloading the rescue force from C-130s to helicopters, which would then take the force onto a landing site near Tehran and back, and second, trucks in waiting near the landing site. Also required were C-130s and crews that were capable of flying blacked-out missions into sites in the desert at night, and a reliable helicopter unit that could take the rescue force from the transload site to Tehran and back. No units capable of performing this mission existed in any of the services. Jim Vaught had to form, equip, and train them. It was a daunting challenge to develop in very little time the individual and unit-level proficiency required to accomplish the job. For example, flying with night vision goggles had never been done before, and Jim Vaught was the right man for the mission. But the units, equipment, and crews available were at best only marginally capable of taking it on. Even more difficult was the establishment of an intelligence and support mechanism inside Iran. Vaught did this partly with CIA support, but primarily by using his own assets, sending his own people into Iran to prepare the way. His plan called for establishing an intelligence support infrastructure in Tehran, whose function was to verify that the hostages were being held in the Chancery, a 90-room structure on the embassy compound, and to arrange for trucks to be waiting near the helicopter landing site for transporting the unit, and later the hostages, back and forth between the landing site and the embassy compound. This mission was accomplished by Major Dick Meadows, three Special Forces NCOs, and two agents provided by the CIA. On April 1, 1980, a one-legged CIA pilot in a small two-engine plane flew Major John Kearney into Iran at night. Kearney's mission was to locate and lay out a 3,000-foot landing strip on a remote desert site in Iran called Desert One. This was to serve as the transload site for the shooters, as well as the refueling site for the helicopter force that would join them after they had been launched from the aircraft carrier Nimitz. The force was composed of 8 Navy Sea Stallion helicopters, not the right aircraft for the job, but the best available in terms of range and payload. Kearney laid out the strip with the help of a small Honda dirt bike he brought on the plane. Once the field was established, he installed an airfield lighting system that could be turned on remotely from the cockpit of the lead C-130, a duty he himself performed on the night of the landing. On April 24, 1980, 132 members of the rescue force arrived at a forward staging base on Masira Island near Oman. There they transloaded to C-130s for the low-level flight to Desert One. That night, the C-130s made it to the Desert One area with no unusual problems, but the helicopters did not arrive as scheduled. Of the 8 Sea Stallions, 6 operational helicopters finally arrived at the desert landing strip an hour and a half late, after an encounter with a severe, unforecasted sandstorm. The other 2 had had mechanical problems before reaching the sandstorm and had returned to the carrier Nimitz. 6 Sea Stallions were enough to carry out the mission, but only barely. If another was lost, then some part of the rescue force would have to be left behind, which was not a good idea. All of the force was essential. Meanwhile, that hour and a half delay made everybody nervous. The helicopters had to leave in time to reach the secluded landing site near Tehran before daylight. The mission's luck did not improve. During refueling, one of the 6 remaining helicopters burned out a hydraulic pump, and now there were 5, not enough to complete the mission, and it was too late to reach the hide site. At that point, the decision was made to abort the mission. It was a choice no one wanted to make, but no other choice was possible. And then came tragedy. After refueling, one of the helicopters was maneuvering in a hover in a cloud of desert dust, following a flashlight to a touchdown location. The helicopter pilot thought the man with the flashlight was a combat ground controller, when in fact he was not. He was simply a man with a flashlight, possibly a C-130 crew member checking out his aircraft. Meanwhile, the helicopter pilot expected the man with the flashlight to be holding still. In fact, he was moving, trying to get away from the dust storm thrown up by the helicopter's blades. This combination of mistakes resulted in the helicopter veering so close to a C-130 that its blades clipped the C-130's wingtip and ignited the fuel stored there, instantly setting off a flaming inferno. In moments, 5 men on the C-130 and 3 men on the helicopter were killed. The commander of the helicopters then elected to abandon all the helicopters rather than risk further disasters. Everyone who wasn't then on a 130 scrambled aboard, and the best America could muster abandoned the Iranian desert site in shocked disarray. The nation suffered a devastating humiliation. Burned and abandoned American equipment littered the desert. 8 Americans had died. The American hostages remained locked up in Tehran. America's enemies laughed. This failure weighed heavily on the troops, who had trained so hard and risked their lives in Iran, all of whom believed that if they could have gotten to Tehran, they could have done the job they'd been sent to do. The failure had in no way been their fault, but the fault of the men who had thrown them together, so unprepared and under-equipped. The consequences of the Desert One failure included 2 key actions that would greatly transform the United States Special Missions capability in the future. First, 2 days after the failed mission, President Carter ordered the Pentagon to prepare a second rescue mission. Carter additionally ordered the Secretary of Defense to make sure that this time the mission had all the resources it needed. Second, the Secretary of Defense appointed an investigative panel, chaired by the former Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral James L. Holloway, to examine the Iranian hostage rescue attempt and to make appropriate suggestions for improving future capability. The panel would recommend that a standing joint task force be established as a national-level asset, with its own headquarters, forces, and necessary capabilities for effective and responsive operations. In August, Major General Richard Dick Schultes became commander of a new organization, the Joint Special Operations Task Force, JSOTF, and was given the mission for the second attempt at rescuing the hostages, codenamed Honey Badger. The planning and training were soon underway and featured serious improvements over the previous attempt. For example, modified Army Blackhawks would now fly the mission, with much greater reliability and range than the Navy RH-53C Stallions that had been used before. Several operational options were worked on, though again with a scarcity of solid intelligence. It was later learned from released hostages that on the date planned for the rescue attempt, less than 5% of the hostages were where the intelligence community thought they were. On President Ronald Reagan's inauguration day, January 20, 1981, the final rehearsal was being conducted at the training site in Texas when it all suddenly became moot. Word came in that the hostages had been released. The mission was no longer needed. The United States military had had nothing to do with it. Rather, Iraq's invasion of Iran on September 22, 1980, had persuaded Iran that its national survival was at stake and that it needed the $12 billion in assets frozen by the Carter administration, including major weapons systems purchased by the Shah, more than it needed the hostages. Iran made the initial moves to free the hostages, timing it to become a political issue in the upcoming election, because they expected a better deal from a Reagan administration. It worked. Though they did not get all $12 billion, the $8 billion they did get was not milk money. Meanwhile, the training and preparation for Operation Honey Badger had greatly improved the readiness and capability of the units involved. Its cancellation would now allow Dick Schultes to devote his full time and attention to future readiness. In the days ahead, readiness and capabilities would grow enough for them to begin responding effectively to mission taskings from Washington. For example, an intelligence report that a prison camp in Laos still contained a number of American POWs from the Vietnam War sparked preparations for a covert rescue operation that would require the development of specific tactics, techniques, procedures, and special equipment. These were developed and rehearsed as part of a very complex plan involving the seizure of an airfield in a friendly country from which the rescue would be launched. Before the launch, however, Dick Schultes, a cautious man and a realist, asked for U.S. eyes on the target to validate the intelligence report. Not only did he want U.S. eyes, he wanted his own people to accompany the CIA's people. This did not happen. Instead, the agency sent a bunch of their guys, none of them American, into Laos. Though they came back with hundreds of pictures, none showed anyone who could be verified as American. Schultes continued to insist on sending his own people in to recon the site, but permission for this could not be obtained, and the mission eventually went away. Even so, efforts were not wasted. Once again, not only was the training useful, but the tactics, techniques, and equipment that had been developed specifically for the mission would remain useful. Later, unwittingly looking forward to October 1985, the Norwegian government, concerned about the emerging terrorist threat and the possible vulnerability of its cruise liner industry, wondered if the United States had the expertise to take down a large luxury liner at sea. To find out, they provided the cruise liner Norwegian Princess as a training aid. Jesotef expertly demonstrated they knew how to perform the task with panache and during darkness. On October 25, 1983, Jesotef took part in Operation Urgent Fury, the invasion of Grenada, in association with a larger force under the command of Cinclant, Commander-in-Chief Atlantic. Urgent Fury's overall mission had three goals: to rescue American students at Grenada's Medical University just outside the capital, St. George's, to rescue the former Governor General, who was being held under house arrest by the new Cuba-backed leftist regime, and to prevent the use of the island by the Cuban or Soviet military. The mission included taking over the entire island. It was not a well-run operation. Though Jesotef was committed to Urgent Fury, the commitment came very late, too late to plan, prepare, and train appropriately. This problem was compounded by intelligence foul-ups. As Dick Schultes recalls, changes in command and control and in missions over the course of the days immediately before H hour, the time of the attack, drove us very close to a major catastrophe on that island. At the start, on Thursday the 20th, we were to run the mission unilaterally. Then on Friday, Cinclant was put in charge, with only a Jesotef involvement. Then on Sunday, the Marine barracks in Beirut was blown up, a giant blow to the spirit of the Marine Corps. And this led again to major changes. During a command briefing at the Pentagon, the Commandant of the Marines announced to the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff that unless the Marines joined the attack on the island, the Corps would never recover. Less than 48 hours before H hour, the Marines had become involved in Urgent Fury, which meant that a totally new overall commander had to be appointed, Admiral Metcalf. Three major command and control changes had been made in as many days. Mission changes came just as fast and furious. On Monday, at the final briefing for Metcalf, the Department of State reps present announced that it was critical to seize the Richmond Hill prison at H hour, even though the Department of State could not tell who was in the prison, who we were to secure, and whether the guards were the good guys or the bad guys. "That doesn't make sense," I told them. "Since we can't ascertain who is in the prison and who are the good guys and the bad guys, we will make it a follow-up target." They insisted, so I asked for a 24 to 48-hour delay to give us time to gather better information. The delay was disapproved. We had also been asking for an 0200 nighttime H hour, but with little success. Everyone would be landing in daylight rather than darkness. We now had a major change in mission for one of our major assault units, and without the adequate intelligence. This meant, among other things, that we had to change the Black Hawk loading on the C-5s that were already at Pope Air Force Base, not easy to do in the time we had. Later, we learned why no one would accept our request for an 0200 H hour or for a 24 to 48 hour delay. The Department of State and the CIA had written a detailed plan for the seizure of the island. This plan included a seven-nation assisting force, which was to land at H plus 3 and then come under Jesotef control. These nations knew 9 days before Jesotef was informed of the mission that the island would be invaded at 0500 on Tuesday the 25th. There was no way we could have changed that. There were other intelligence mix-ups. For example, the intelligence community told us that all the medical students were located at the university's True Blue campus, which we targeted. They were not. More than half were at Grand Anne's, about 2 miles away on the other side of the island. Another example, the intelligence community claimed there were only 2 40-millimeter anti-aircraft guns on the island. The truth was, the enemy had about 6 mixed 40-millimeter and 2 quad 50s at the airfield. And at Fort Frederick, which overlooked the helicopter approach to Richmond Hill Prison, There were an additional two 40mm and two quad 50s. Another problem, air support. Without our AC-130 gunships, the entire mission would have been an even greater failure. And then Admiral Metcalf had the audacity to warn me that no close air support would be available to us. I told him I was using only my organic assets, and I guess he never understood. Considering the challenges of this demanding operation, compounded by the half-baked command and mission changes, together with the risk of conducting such complex operations against heavily defended targets in broad daylight with little or no accurate intelligence information and without the correct support of conventional commanders, Jasotev somehow brought off the missions we'd been assigned and made lemonade out of a lemon. One glaring example of the kind of problem Schultes mentions was a mission performed by the Navy SEALs. At first light, the SEALs planned to airdrop a reconnaissance team with boats, called a night boat drop, and to observe and report activities at Salinas Airfield in preparation for a Ranger assault to secure the airfield. As it turned out, this SEAL team had never made a night boat drop. The two C-130 crews assigned to conduct the drop had never made a boat drop at all, and the drop did not take place at first light, but in total darkness, in a sudden and unforecasted squall. The waves were much higher than expected. One plane dropped its SEALs 2 miles from the other, and in the end, four SEALs drowned. Their bodies were never recovered. Two other targets assigned to the SEALs were the Governor General's mansion and the radio station approximately 7 miles away. Even though they had trained to operate at night in order to take advantage of the darkness, both SEAL teams were inserted in daylight. The SEAL team tasked with securing the Governor General's mansion had the added complication of bringing in a 3-man State Department radio team, which carried a portable broadcast radio with them to allow the Governor General to broadcast to the nation that he was okay and still in charge. As soon as they hit the ground, the SEAL team that was supposed to secure the radio station became involved in heavy fighting with an armed guard force. They were outmanned and outgunned. After the team leader and one of his men were wounded, the team was forced to withdraw back to the coast until they could be picked up at night. The team securing the Governor General's mansion fared better, but their operation was not without problems either. As their helicopters approached the mansion, they found no place to land, a consequence of poor intelligence preparation. The terrain was too steep and covered with large trees. That meant the assault team had to slide down a 75-foot rope in order to get on the ground and clear a landing zone for the helicopter carrying the State Department radio team. As the helicopter moved around the mansion's grounds, it began taking heavy anti-aircraft fire from a nearby hill. Though the helicopter was hit several times and the co-pilot was severely wounded, the pilot did a magnificent job of keeping the helicopter from crashing. He later made it back to the operation's flagship, Guam, which had hospital facilities on board. Meanwhile, the SEALs had secured the facility and had the governor and his wife well in hand and in good spirits when suddenly three armored personnel carriers appeared at the mansion's gate. The SEALs quickly got control of the situation, however, by calling in an AC-130 gunship. The gunship blasted the APCs just as they were swinging their turrets toward the mansion. The SEALs did very well, considering what they had to work with, but there were failures above them. During Operation Urgent Fury, Carl Steiner was in Beirut. Even so, he was able to monitor the battle on a SATCOM radio connection he shared with the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Jack Vesey. Vesey had given Steiner the frequency of his private channel, so he could communicate directly with the chairman. But it also allowed him to listen to all the reports coming in during Urgent Fury. Because Steiner and Schultes had been friends and neighbors at Fort Bragg, where Steiner had been Assistant Division Commander for Operations of the 82nd Airborne Division before he was sent to Lebanon in August 1983, listening to the SATCOM reports was a disheartening experience. I could really feel how Dick Schultes must have suffered, he observes, all caused by factors over which he had no control. For the next 10 months, Dick Schultes worked day and night to make sure such things would never happen again, and to develop the best capability possible for counterterrorism and other unanticipated special mission requirements. In August 1984, when Steiner himself assumed command from Dick Schultes, he received the best-trained and most competent joint headquarters and the finest special missions units in the world. Steiner's mission was to make it even better by making sure the United States was never so caught by surprise that it had no forces appropriately prepared to deal with the situation. When a joint special operations task force is committed, all other options for solving the problem have either proved inappropriate or inadequate. Thus, the stakes are high. But no matter how superbly trained and prepared you are, operations can fail, even when you make all the right moves. Sometimes the terrorists operate within secure sanctuaries, such as Beirut, where they can't be hit. Sometimes delay and indecision from above prevent you from taking timely action to seize the best opportunities. Both elements would haunt the command in June 1985, just 4 months before the events aboard the Achille Lauro. On Friday, June 14, 1985, at 10 a.m. local time, TWA Flight 847 took off from Athens Airport, headed for Rome, with 153 passengers and crew on board, 135 of whom were American. The plane, a relatively short-range Boeing 727, was piloted by Captain John Testrake. Its co-pilot was First Officer Philip Marska, and Christian Zimmerman was the flight engineer. According to information later provided by Greek authorities, the day before, three young men in their 20s had traveled from Beirut to Athens, spent the night in the Athens terminal, and then tried to make reservations on the Athens to Rome leg of Flight 847. Their intent? To hijack the aircraft. It was a full flight, however, and only two of them, traveling under the code names Castro and Saeed, and later identified as Muhammad Ali Hamadi and Hassan Izz al-Din, were able to get seats. The one who had to stay behind in Athens would later be identified as Ali Atwa, and held by Greek authorities as soon as his part in the hijack became known. The three of them, as it now seems, belonged to Hezbollah, a radical, revolutionary terrorist faction with ties to Iran. The hijack was a Hezbollah operation, though other factions active in Lebanon would also make their presence felt as the event played out. Once they were on board, Castro and Saeed took seats in the rear of the plane near the lavatory, where the weapons used in the hijacking had been stashed, most likely by airport employees. One of them took a small carry-on bag into the lavatory and secured the weapons, two pistols and hand grenades. As soon as the plane reached flight altitude, the two terrorists went into action. They leapt from their seats and ran to the front of the plane. When they got there, they pushed the flight attendant, Uli Derrickson, to the floor, screaming all the while in Arabic and broken English, "Come to die! Americans die!" They then tried to make their presence known to the cockpit crew by knocking Uli Derrickson's head against the cockpit door. After they'd shoved a grenade in her face and a gun in her ear, she somehow managed to get to the intercom and inform Christian Zimmerman that a hijacking was taking place. Captain Testrake immediately ordered the door of the cabin to be opened, and the two hijackers shouted their first demand. They wanted to go to Algeria. This was not possible. The 727 didn't have enough fuel on board, so the captain recommended Cairo instead. This suggestion made the already jumpy terrorists even more upset. "If not Algeria, then Beirut," they shouted. "Fuel only." Captain Testrake changed course and headed toward Beirut, which was 700 miles away and only just barely within range. Meanwhile, Castro ordered all the passengers in the first class section to move to the rear of the airplane. Since there were not enough seats available, some of them were forced to sit with other passengers. He then directed Uli Derrickson to gather all the passports so he could tell which passengers were American and/or Jewish. Once the passports had been collected, Castro ordered Uli to pick out the Israelis, but it turned out that no Israelis were aboard. He then told her to select the Jews, but that also proved impossible, since American passports do not show religion. Growing more impatient, he had her read the passenger list for him. When she came to what sounded like a Jewish name, he ordered her to find that passenger's passport. Seven people fit this category. Castro next shifted his attention to military ID cards. Servicemen usually travel on their ID cards rather than passports. Aboard the plane were an Army reservist named Kurt Carlson and six Navy divers returning from an underwater job in Greece. Castro and Saeed forced the divers to move to widely separated seats, yelling, "Marines! The New Jersey!" The battleship New Jersey had recently fired on Beirut, and 1,500 Marines had been stationed at the Beirut airport. Then Castro ordered all passengers to sit with their heads between their legs without looking up. When TWA 847 reached the Beirut area, it was very low on fuel. Even so, Beirut control denied the aircraft permission to land. Since this did not please the hijackers, one of them, who was in the cockpit at the time, pulled the pin of a hand grenade and threatened to blow up the airliner. Captain Testrake decided he had no choice but to bluff his way in. That worked, and they were able to set down safely and park. They then waited for refueling. The terrorists still intended to go to Algeria. As they touched down, the cockpit crew couldn't help but notice the wreckage of a Jordanian airliner blown up 2 days earlier by the PLO. Because the Lebanese were far from eager to get involved in the ongoing crisis, they ignored the request for fuel. That meant that the terrorists were again displeased. To make clear their determination, they tightly bound the hands of Navy diver Robert Stethem with a bungee cord, dragged him to the front of the airplane, beat him savagely enough to break all his ribs, then dumped him, moaning and bleeding, in a seat near the front of the plane. When the captain radioed the tower, "They are beating the passengers and threatening to kill them," the Lebanese authorities were persuaded to send a refueling truck to TWA 847. Because it was a long flight to Algeria, Testrake had to take on all the fuel the plane could hold, making the plane some 15,000 pounds overweight with a full load of passengers, and unsafe for takeoff. In view of that, the hijackers agreed to let 17 women and 2 children go. They left by sliding down the emergency escape chutes. Releasing the passengers not only made the plane safer, it reduced the number of people that the hijackers had to control and provided access to a source of intelligence about what was happening on the plane. Predictably, considering the delay and indecision that marked the whole sequence of events, it was several hours before the released passengers could be flown to Cyprus, 100 miles away, where they could be interviewed in detail by American officials. Meanwhile, word of the hijacking did not reach Washington officials until about 4 a.m. Washington time. Jasotev learned of it shortly thereafter from news reports picked up by its Reuters and BBC monitors. Crisis management teams started gathering at the Federal Aviation Administration, the Pentagon, the State Department, and the White House Situation Room, but none of them had more than sketchy details. At 6:30 Friday morning Washington time, TWA 847 cleared the runway in Beirut and headed for Algeria, 1,800 miles away. By that time, the gears in Washington had started to grind into motion. The Pentagon had been ready to respond immediately. It operates 24 hours a day. But no one with sufficient rank to make a decision had been available at the White House or State Department. The administration's terrorist incident working group did not meet until approximately 10 a.m. that morning. Meanwhile, at Fort Bragg, Jasotev had already alerted its own forces in anticipation that Americans could be on board the hijacked aircraft, as well as the military airlift command, since lift assets would be needed soon. And the J-3 operations officer of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, requesting Pentagon authority for immediate deployment. The forces that would take part in the operation would come primarily from Army Special Forces and an Army Special Operations helicopter unit. They expected to fly first to Sigonella, a NATO base on Sicily operated jointly by the United States and Italy, and therefore strategically located at the midpoint of the Mediterranean. Since only 2 lightly armed terrorists were in charge of the airplane, excellent conditions existed for a takedown, if, as seemed to be the case, Algeria was in fact TWA 847's destination, and if it was possible to persuade the Algerians to hold the plane on the ground. With this scenario in mind, Jasotev requested USUCOM, European Command, to authorize 2 C-130 combat Talon aircraft, capable of low-level flight and landing in total darkness, to be prepared to deploy from Mindenhall, England, to Sigonella. Jasotev had additionally requested another TWA Boeing 727, identical to the hijacked aircraft, to join the task force at Sigonella. Since JASOTF maintained a detailed database covering every airfield in those regions of the world where terrorist incidents were likely to take place, it was aware of all the characteristics of the Algerian airfield to which the hijacked plane would most likely head. Thus, JASOTF had two takedown options. Combat Talon aircraft carrying the rescue force could land blacked out at night, or the second TWA-727 could be used as a Trojan horse. All the while, valuable time was being wasted. The force had been ready to go soon after learning of the hijacking, but, as was the case in the past, and as would be the case later that year in October, neither airlift nor crews qualified to fly these missions were available. Rounding them up consumed valuable time, time the terrorists used most efficiently to stay ahead of JASOTF's reaction time. When the administration's Terrorist Incident Working Group finally met on Friday morning, they recommended that the task force be dispatched immediately. If airlift had been readily available, Steiner and his forces, including the combat Talons from England and the TWA-727, could have been arriving at Sigonella at about the time TWA-847 was approaching Algeria. However, the Pentagon was reluctant to launch the task force until TWA-847 settled down wherever it was going. By midday Algerian time, during, as it happened, the Muslim holy season of Ramadan, TWA-847 was approaching Algeria. While en route there, Castro made a broadcast in Arabic over the plane's radio, detailing the terrorist demands. He wanted more than 700 Shiites released from prison in Israel, 17 other Shiites freed from a prison in Kuwait, 2 other Shiites released from Spain, and 2 others from Cyprus. Additionally, he wanted Israel to withdraw from southern Lebanon, the United States to admit responsibility for a recent car bombing in Beirut, and the world to condemn America for its support of Israel. These demands were, of course, impossible to meet. As the aircraft was approaching the airfield in Algeria, the State Department passed on to Ambassador Michael Newland a directive from President Reagan. He was to contact Algerian President Chadli Benjedid and make 2 requests. First, to make an exception to Algeria's policy that hijacked aircraft not be allowed to land. And second, to keep the plane on the ground and not permit it to take off again after landing. Looking back over the entire TWA-847 affair, it is possible to see that the United States had only one real opportunity to rescue the hostages without high risk of bloodshed. It was during that first stopover in Algeria. That opportunity was blown, however. Instead of doing everything in his power to make direct contact with President Benjedid, as he'd been instructed, Michael Newland settled for subordinates, and then he allowed the Algerian subordinates to pretty much call the shots. As he later reported, most of his own staff was unavailable, having already taken off to Mediterranean beaches for the weekend, and he found few members of the Algerian government who would take his calls. Newland did manage to get hold of Benjedid's chief of staff, however, and 45 minutes later, he called back to say that TWA-847 would be permitted to land on humanitarian grounds. By this time, TWA-847 was already requesting permission to land and had less than 30 minutes of fuel remaining. After landing, the terrorists decided to return to Beirut to pick up reinforcements, causing another problem with refueling, which meant that another American serviceman, Army Reservist Kurt Carlson, was beaten. Again, though, that facilitated matters, though the flight attendant, Uli Derrickson, had to pay for the fuel with her Shell credit card, since TWA didn't have landing facilities in Algeria. She was billed for 6,000 gallons of jet fuel at $1 a gallon. On the other hand, the terrorists released another 21 passengers, 18 of them American. Once the refueling was completed, TWA-847 took off again and headed back toward Beirut. The Algerian government made no move to hold the plane on the ground. Meanwhile, an Air Force C-141 was launching from Andrews Air Force Base just outside Washington, D.C., with the 20-man emergency support team headed by a senior State Department official, Ambassador David Long. Joining him were a senior CIA official, formerly a senior station chief, representatives from the Defense Intelligence Agency, communications and technical personnel, selected members of the White House National Security Staff, and a couple of senior Special Forces officers who would act in an advisory and coordination role. The Emergency Support Team's mission was to precede the task force, assist the ambassador and his staff, and interface with CSOTIF, the State Department, and national intelligence agencies. After some indecision about the best place to go, the team decided to land at Sigonella. It was 2 in the morning when TWA 847 began its approach for its second landing in Beirut. The runway marker lights were out. The airport was blacked out. Once again, the Beirut control tower refused permission to land, and once again, Captain Testrake was desperate. "I have no more than 20 minutes of fuel left," he explained to the tower. "I'm coming in, even if it means landing next to the runway." When Testrake broke out of the clouds 500 feet above the airport, he could see vehicles blocking the runway. He radioed to the tower. "We're in deadly danger. I implore you to open your airport and let us land." The controller replied, "Unfortunately, my superiors do not care about your problems." "If we try to land, we'll crash," Testrake told the hijackers. "Good," one answered. "That will save us the trouble of blowing it up." "Prepare the passengers for a crash landing," Testrake told Uli Derrickson. He then made an announcement to the passengers. "We are low on fuel and have to land. We have fuel for only one approach. We're going in. Prepare for a crash landing. If they do not remove the obstacles, we will land on the ground beside the runway. Otherwise, we will have to land in the water." But with 3 miles to go, the runway lights flashed on, the vehicles were removed, and the tower told Testrake he was clear to land. Another gut cruncher. These were getting to be a habit. Once the aircraft was on the ground, the hijackers ordered Testrake to stop in the middle of the runway, far from any buildings. Castro and Saeed then began talking to the tower in Arabic, their voices increasingly angry. They were demanding that reinforcements be allowed to board the plane, and the Lebanese authorities were resisting their demands. "I don't want to talk to you," one of them screamed at the controller. "I only talk to the Amal." Amal was an armed Shiite faction in Beirut, headed by a lawyer named Nabi Bari, with ties to Syrian President Hafez Assad. Amal was somewhat more moderate than Hezbollah. As later became apparent, Assad was working behind the scenes with Amal and Hezbollah's Iranian masters to resolve the situation, but on terms that would be to his political advantage. "You are trying to gain time," the terrorist continued. "You don't believe me. We'll kill this Marine." He meant Robert Stethem, the Navy diver who had been beaten during the first landing in Beirut. Castro then dragged Stethem, screaming in agony, to the open door of the aircraft, placed a pistol to the back of his head, and fired. Then he dumped his body onto the tarmac. "He has just killed a passenger," the pilot reported. As he spoke, Castro snatched the microphone and said, "You see, you now believe. There will be another in 5 minutes." At this point, Castro ordered Testrake to taxi to the refueling points. The terrorists never forgot that time was precious. The longer they stayed in one place, the greater the window for a takedown attempt. Thus, they bounced back and forth from one place to the other. "As I began moving down the runway," Testrake later remembered, "I turned the wheel sharply to avoid running over the young serviceman's body." As all of this was going on, everyone on the plane had fallen silent, horrified at the violence, until one of the terrorists started singing a song. It was a song of celebration, Uli Derrickson recalled. Meanwhile, the terrorists chose their next victim, Clinton Suggs, another Navy diver. "The hijacker came back where I was," Suggs recalled, "and he was kicking me and hitting me and calling me American pig. I thought I was dead. I prayed and asked the Lord to receive me in his arms." All of a sudden, the back door of the plane opened, and 10 or 12 heavily armed militiamen carrying automatic weapons rushed onto the plane, screaming and shouting. The terrorists had succeeded in getting their reinforcements and multiplying the difficulty of a takedown. One of the 12, who identified himself as Gehad and spoke fluent English, was in fact one of Lebanon's leading terrorists, Imad Mugniha. Mugnia had once been a member of Amal, but at this time he was with Hezbollah. Their enforcer, Mugnia, now took charge of the operation. After the aircraft was refueled, six Americans, including Kurt Carlson, Clinton Suggs, and three other Navy divers, were ordered into seats in the last two rows of the plane. Shortly after that, the six were rushed down the back steps of the plane into a waiting enclosed truck. A few moments later, a second group of five passengers, another Navy diver, and four of the seven with Jewish-sounding names, were also taken off the plane, loaded into another truck, and whisked away. Flight 847 then took off again, headed for Algeria. The second Algerian episode would last until Sunday. It was now daybreak Saturday. Robert Stethem's body had already been dumped on the tarmac in Beirut before Carl Steiner was given authority to launch with his Jesotef. 6 to 8 more hours of flying time were required before they could be in position to resolve the situation. While Steiner was en route, the State Department had directed Ambassador Newland to ask the Algerians for permission to bring in Long's emergency support team, who by then had reached Sigonella. According to Newland, however, the Algerians refused. They could not permit a rescue mission, and that's what the EST, with its Air Force C-141, seemed to be. Unable to bring in his aircraft or his entire team, Long did the best he could. He pared his numbers down by a third and flew this smaller group by commercial air to Algiers by way of Marseille. Meanwhile, Jesotef and the rest of the support team had arrived in Sigonella, having planned the rescue operation en route. Soon after landing, they linked up with the TWA 727 and the two combat Talon aircraft from England. All the pieces were now in place for a rescue operation, and sufficient darkness remained to reach Algeria and conduct the operation before daylight. However, a rescue operation would be a different ball game now. Instead of the pair of lightly armed terrorists that had been on board the first time the plane landed in Algeria, there were now 14 heavily armed Hezbollah militiamen on the plane, some armed with machine guns. The only thing the task force team could do now was wait in the hangar for further developments. TWA 847 landed once again in Algeria early Saturday morning, and they would remain there this time for just over 24 hours. During the just completed Beirut to Algiers leg of the 847 Odyssey, the hijackers had systematically robbed everyone else on the plane. Soon after the aircraft landed, the hijackers made another demand. They wanted the Greek government to release Ali Atwa, their accomplice who had been arrested at the Athens airport the day before. If he was not released, the hijackers promised they would kill the plane's Greek passengers. If he was, the Greek passengers would be freed. The Greeks caved in, and that afternoon, an Olympic Airways jet took off from Athens bound for Algeria with Ali Atwa on board. The Algerians, however, managed to use the release of Atwa to extract a few more concessions from the terrorists, who agreed to free everyone on the plane except the American male passengers and crew. According to Michael Newland, the Algerians negotiated a brilliant deal. "They were absolutely superb," he said. "They made the terrorists pay for everything." What the terrorists paid for was not obvious to Steiner. The terrorists had been in total control all along, and still were. Newland later recalled that when he left the airport early Sunday morning, he was certain that the Algerians and the International Committee of the Red Cross would resolve the crisis without further bloodshed. Armed with that conviction, he went to sleep. A few hours later, an embassy officer called him. The hijackers were again demanding fuel. Newland then called the Secretary General of the Algerian Presidency, the Algerian executive's chief administrative officer, and reiterated the American position. "Everything possible should be done to keep the plane on the ground," he told him, "even if it means shooting out the tires." Moments later, the embassy officer reported to Newland that TWA 847 was taking off. Newland again got on the phone with the Secretary General. "We had to let them go," the Algerian told him. "The hijackers threatened to blow up the plane." Later, the Algerians offered a second excuse. "The hijackers undoubtedly heard radio reports that U.S. Special Forces were on the way," they explained. That statement was disingenuous. Whether or not the hijackers had heard such reports, most of which were, as it happened, inaccurate, their actions had proved they were worried about a rescue attempt from the very start. They didn't need a news report to tell them that they'd been on the ground too long in Algeria. In the meantime, the U.S. government had failed to gain Algerian approval of a rescue operation. But even if they had gotten it, the situation had become agonizingly complex. Unlike the first time TWA-847 had landed in Algeria, the terrorists were clearly in control. Not only had their numbers grown, but they'd unloaded a total of 31 hostages in Beirut, at least 19 of whom had been dispersed among the heavily armed militias holed up in the labyrinthine southern suburbs of Beirut. It was now impossible to rescue all the hostages in a single attempt. TWA-847 took off for Beirut shortly after 8 a.m., after spending more than 25 hours on the ground in Algeria. A half hour later, an Air Alsace plane arrived from Marseille, carrying David Long and five members of his emergency support team, too late to affect the outcome of the TWA-847 hijack drama. TWA-847 was gone from Algiers forever. Meanwhile, as TWA-847 was winging once again toward Beirut, Captain Testrake managed to listen in as the terrorists were making further plans. Their new idea was to take on more fuel in Beirut, then move on, he thought, to Tehran. That was definitely not what Testrake wanted. Once they landed in Beirut this time, he decided, he would see to it that they did not take off again. Testrake and Zimmerman, the flight engineer, then worked out a plan of their own. And when the plane touched down in Beirut, Zimmerman shut off the fuel valve and switched off the electrical power to one of the engines. Lights began flashing like mad on the instrument panel. TWA-847 can't go anywhere, Testrake explained to Mugnia, until a new engine can be brought in from the States. It was now Sunday afternoon in Beirut, Sunday morning in Washington. By this time, Carl Steiner had reached the conclusion that the two combat Talons and the TWA-727 were no longer useful, and with Pentagon approval, released them. He then loaded up the rest of the force and headed to Cyprus, where he was later joined by David Long and his emergency support team. Steiner still had sufficient capability to conduct a rescue operation, and he still hoped that as this thing played out, an opportunity might present itself. This was going to be far from easy. Beirut was a much tougher nut to crack than Algeria. 30 passengers were made on the plane. Their location, at least, was known, but the 19 taken off the plane earlier were almost impossible to locate. The armed militias that controlled South Beirut were now holding them in separate locations there, mostly in basements. They might as well have been at the bottom of the sea. Reliable intelligence information was scarce in Beirut in those days. U.S. national overhead systems, satellites, could not, for example, intercept militia communications, since they communicated by handheld, low-level frequency radios or by messenger. Far worse, the American intelligence network had been tragically blown after the recent kidnapping and torture of the CIA station chief, William Buckley. The U.S. had no choice but to assume that Buckley had revealed his network of agents and that they had all been neutralized. As soon as Steiner reached Cyprus, he called Reggie Bartholomew, the American ambassador in Lebanon, brought him up to date, and asked how Jasotef could help. Though the two men had not seen each other in over a year, they knew each other well, having been together in 1983 and early 1984 when the heaviest fighting had taken place in Beirut. The two men had been on the receiving end of many shellings and had met many times with the factional leaders, now holding at least 19 of the TWA-847 hostages. These experiences had built up considerable mutual respect. "What I'd like you to do," Bartholomew told Steiner, "is fly over here with a couple of your people and a couple of people from the EST. Once you're in Beirut, we'll decide the best course of action. Then you can go back to Cyprus and set things up." Steiner immediately loaded Lieutenant Colonel Pete, the two ranking members of the EST team, one from the State Department and one from the CIA, and a SATCOM radio and its operators onto a helicopter and set off for Beirut. TWA-847 was clearly visible on the Beirut International Airport tarmac as they made their final approach to the landing pad near the ambassador's residence. Bartholomew's first priority, not surprisingly, was to keep TWA-847 under surveillance. "We have a superb surveillance capability with us," Steiner told him. "As soon as I get back to Cyprus, I'll send it to you." Meanwhile, the rest of the team Steiner had brought with him from Cyprus, including the SATCOM and operators, stayed in Beirut with the ambassador, so there'd be constant communication. The surveillance team Steiner sent back to Ambassador Bartholomew consisted of four people, bringing with them day and night long-range surveillance capability. An hour after their arrival in Beirut, he had them positioned in a house on a ridge overlooking Beirut International Airport. For the next several hours, this team was the sole source of intelligence on what was happening on TWA-847. But that night, the Amal militia downloaded the remaining hostages and crew and dispersed them within the south suburbs. There was no longer any way to know where any of the hostages were. At this point, though, they waited on Cyprus for an additional 2 weeks. Carl Steiner and Jasotef's role in the TWA-847 affair ended. Now it was up to negotiations between Syria, Iran, and the factional leaders. Washington also produced a number of diplomatic initiatives, but these also seemed to have had little effect on the final outcome. Finally, Hafez Assad struck a deal, and the hostages were released to travel to Damascus, where they would be passed over into the hands of the American ambassador. It was a prestigious victory for Assad, at least in the Arab world, and a humiliating experience for Steiner and his companions. In General Carl Steiner's words, "Watching the Red Cross vans carry the hostages out of Beirut towards Damascus was a bitter experience. We could not get out of our minds the certainty that we'd had the capability to do a rescue operation that would have been a piece of cake. But we failed to bring it off. We just never had the opportunity. If only three factors, all beyond our control, could have been changed, this situation might well have been different. One, we needed dedicated aircraft maintained at the same alert standard that we were. Two, we should have been launched as soon as we'd learned of the hijacking. Three, we needed the Algerian government to hold TWA-847 on the ground and then to allow us to conduct a rescue operation. With all that in mind, as we flew back home, I decided to speak straight in the debriefing I'd very soon be giving to the chairman and joint chiefs of staff. The next day in the Pentagon, I gave my debriefing. After going through the story in detail, which they were all pretty much aware of from my constant communication, I concluded with something like the following. Gentlemen, we should all be embarrassed by the failure we have just struggled through. In my mind, the consequences of failure of this nature are just as devastating as losing a major battle, especially politically. We ought to be able to figure out that the terrorists understand better than we do the timing of the decision-making process here in Washington and the time required for launching and getting to where they have perpetrated their action, and that they are operating within that cycle. Consequently, we are always chasing our tail, and we always will be unless we do something about this situation. We are the most powerful nation in the world, and if we cannot give this mission the appropriate priority with dedicated lift assets, then we ought to get out of this business and quit wasting the taxpayers' money." I realized that these were mighty big words for a person of my rank to be saying in this situation, but I felt I owed it to them and to my people in the task force. I also felt that General Vesey, the chairman, General Shai Meyer, chief of staff of the Army, and General P.X. Kelly, commandant of the Marine Corps, whom I had worked for as his chief of staff of the Rapid Deployment Joint Task Force, and whose Marines in Beirut had not long ago been killed by a terrorist with a truck bomb, understood clearly what I was recommending. I felt certain that they would, with the support of the other service chiefs, make it happen. And they did. Within the next months, C-141s double-crewed were placed on the same alert string as we were, though too late to affect the outcome of the events of October. This initiative, together with the latitude and authority already given to the command to establish relationships and provide assistance to friendly nations who desired them, have proved very beneficial in the war against terrorism. October 7, 1985. It was time to test the new initiatives. Soon after Steiner arrived at the JOC, he learned the identity of the hijacked ship. It was the Italian cruise liner Achille Lauro. The information came by way of a tantalizingly brief emergency message from the ship, which had been received by a radio station in Göteborg, Sweden. According to the message, a group of armed men had taken control of the liner off the coast of Egypt. And that was it. It was very little to go on, but enough to be able to figure out what forces would be required to take the ship down, and to know that they needed to launch instantly. Because this was a complex target, and because no one knew whether the takedown would be in a port or somewhere on the high seas, Steiner instructed J3, Operations Officer Colonel Frank Akers, to notify the commanders to prepare the following units for immediate deployment. Akers had already given them a heads up. SEALs, required assault teams, sniper teams, and special boat detachments. Since this was to be primarily a maritime operation, the Navy SEALs would play the leading role. Other selected personnel and special units, leaders, planners, and intelligence operators, approximately 25 personnel. The Army Special Helicopter Package, 10 Black Hawks, 6 Little Bird gunships, and 4 Little Bird lift ships. This was the standard alert package that had been developed over time. It was adequate for the mission and would fit in available jet transports. Air Force Special Tactics Operation for airfield control and pararescue. The Task Force Command Group, necessary operations and intelligence staff officers, communications, and medical personnel. Though the SEALs were expertly trained in takedowns and could do the job in a matter of minutes, a cruise ship is the toughest of targets. First, the takedown must be done at night while the ship is underway, because nobody has yet figured out a way to stop a ship without damaging it. Then, once the SEALs are aboard, they have to take out all the terrorists they can on their initial sweep, control the passengers and crew, and search at least 1,000 rooms, nooks, and crannies, and clear them of hidden terrorists, and possibly explosives. Once the force package had been designated, Steiner instructed his deputy commander, Brigadier General Frank Kelly, to begin working the military airlift command for the long-range strategic lift aircraft needed, but with capabilities designed specifically for special operations needs. It was a much larger force than was normally required, but this would be a very complex and challenging target. Airlift, Steiner knew, would be the long pole in the tent, since it was under the control of the Military Airlift Command and outside his authority. Although the task force had a readiness requirement to be wheels up in 2 hours, the necessary lift was not maintained in the same alert status, especially the C-5s. Additionally, the specially trained SOL-2 crews, Special Operations Low-Level Crews, fly blacked out, low-level, and in all-weather conditions, had to be rounded up to fly the planes. The terrorists were not dumb. They knew our reaction time based upon the distance that had to be traveled and the time the Washington decision-making cycle usually took, and they operated inside these times. Every minute counted. The JASOTF standing request was to launch immediately after first notification of an incident. If it turned out no U.S. interest was involved, then the planes could be turned around over the Atlantic and brought home. But if there was a threat, the task force would be way ahead of the game. Meanwhile, Steiner had to check with Washington for further intelligence, and since approval authority for launch and execution came from the Secretary of Defense and the President, he had to see about that as well, working through the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, or his assistant, who communicated with the Defense Secretary. At about 0900, Steiner called the J3 of the Joint Staff, who, like Steiner, was available 24 hours a day, to see if he had any further intelligence and to request permission to launch his liaison teams. The J3 would then take the request to the chairman, Admiral William Crow, who had taken over the job only 3 weeks earlier. The three-man liaison teams were always on standby. Each team, an operations officer, a colonel or lieutenant colonel, an intelligence officer, a major, and a SATCOM radio operator, gave Steiner immediate access to any key people who might be players during a crisis. The liaison teams always knew what he was thinking and doing, and were authorized to speak for him. The J3 assured Steiner that he would get back to him soon after sending the liaison teams. Information is sketchy and incomplete, he continued, but the ship seems to have been hijacked near Alexandria, Egypt, after dropping off most of its passengers for a tour of the pyramids. There are indications that Americans are among the remaining passengers, but it's not known how many got off for the tour and how many remain on board. Good news, Steiner answered. That means a lot fewer to sort and control, but all the more reason to launch right away. You'll be glad to know, then, that the OSG will be meeting soon, he replied. The OSG would influence the launch decision. We should have some decision from them shortly. The U.S. Interagency Crisis Team, also known as the Operational Subgroup, OSG, or Terrorist Incident Working Group, was chaired by the National Security Advisor, Bud McFarlane. But since McFarlane was out of town accompanying the president on a trip to Chicago, his deputy, Vice Admiral John Poindexter, was running the meeting. Its members included from the State Department, Ambassador for Counterterrorism Robert Oakley, and Assistant Secretary of Defense Noel Cook, Charles Allen from the CIA, Oliver Buck Revell from the FBI, Fred Fielding from the White House staff, and Oliver North from the NSC staff. The group's mission was to monitor crisis situations and coordinate interagency support as appropriate for the situation. Though the group had an operational role, it was not in the chain of command, but did make appropriate recommendations to the National Security Council. It was already early afternoon when Steiner called the J-3 again to inform him that except for the airlift, the task force was ready to go, and to please emphasize this to Admiral Crow. We have to take the ship down during darkness, Steiner told the J-3, which means it's imperative that we get at least as far as Sigonella come daylight tomorrow, Tuesday, October 8th. This will give us options we would not otherwise have. Though this was Admiral Crow's first crisis since becoming the chairman, his assistant, Vice Admiral Arthur Art Moreau, had done that job for a couple of years. He knew the ropes, had worked previous crises, had personal relationships with several key allies, and could make things happen quickly. Special Operations Forces had been back and forth through Sigonella so many times during 1985, reacting to terrorist incidents and setting up planning and liaison for the future, that Steiner had stationed a permanent liaison team and SATCOM there as an extension of the United States Commander's Operations Center. This team was Steiner's eyes and ears throughout the Mediterranean, and it operated 24 hours a day, collecting operational and intelligence information and coordinating Gisotof's requirements for passing through Sigonella. Sigonella was a vital base as far as Gisotof's operations were concerned, and the commander of the United States side, Navy Captain Bill Spearman, knew how to make things happen. Spearman always took care of Gisotof's needs, no matter what they were, but also had very good relations with his Italian counterparts, though on one occasion, as luck would have it, Steiner and Spearman had worked out plans, should the need ever arise, for Spearman to take control of the airport control tower from the Italians, who normally ran it. The plan actually had to be put into effect later that week. Sometime during mid-afternoon, word finally came from Washington approving the launch of Steiner's liaison teams. They all departed in civilian clothes, traveling by commercial air. Colonel Dave headed the team that would set up at the embassy in Rome. Another team flew to Stuttgart, Germany, home of the U.S. European Command, USUCOM. Another team went to Gaeta, Italy, Vice Admiral Frank Kelso's 6th Fleet headquarters. And one went to the Military Airlift Command at Scott Air Force Base in St. Louis, Missouri. During the afternoon, Steiner had a conference call with the commanders of his task force to coordinate their actions. Each command had already exchanged liaison officers, which was normal operating procedure, and it was the same people each time. Every hour or so, he talked to Washington, pressing for airlift and the decision to launch. Time was passing. Meanwhile, additional intelligence began to trickle in, but the actual whereabouts of the Achille Lauro was unknown, though reconnaissance planes from the USS Saratoga were looking for it. At long last, at about 1700 hours, Steiner was informed that approval had finally been given to launch the task force. The airplanes would be arriving shortly. Everyone moved quickly to their departure airfields and prepared for outloading. All the required equipment, helicopters, special boats, etc., had already been made ready, And now it was just a matter of loading, which would not take very long once the planes arrived. Soon after that, a call came to Steiner from a member of the National Security Council staff, wanting to know why they were taking so long to get underway. "We've been ready most of the day," Steiner told him. "Maybe you can help by calling the Pentagon to speed up our airlift." The airlift arrived at about midnight, 12 to 14 hours after Steiner had hoped to be in the air. During the loading, special hatch mount antennas were installed on the airplanes, both for plane-to-plane communications en route and for communications with any major commands that might be involved with the operation. The airplanes were also quickly configured inside with working tables and communications modules for operational planning. On Steiner's plane, in addition to the battle staff of colonels, lieutenant colonels, and majors engaged in operational intelligence, air operations, and the like, there were Air Force combat controllers and communicators, about 20 operator shooters, and the medical surgical suite. An operating table had been set up on the tailgate. Major Dr. Darrell Poor, the task force's chief medical officer, had procured state-of-the-art medical equipment from all over the world and had assembled a stable of specialist surgeons who could, if necessary, perform emergency surgery on the tailgate of the plane. At about 0100 on October 8th, the aircraft began lifting off for Sigonella. Since the Achille Lauro still had not been located, Steiner's plan was to stop there briefly and drop off a small team of SEALs and a pair of Little Bird gunships. This was a precautionary measure in case they were needed later. They were. Then he planned to continue quickly onto a military base on Cyprus, which was strategically located in the eastern part of the Mediterranean and within helicopter range of most potential targets. The task force was familiar with this base and had used it several times before. But using it came with conditions. Because of Soviet intelligence satellite, Satran, passes, Chasotev aircraft had to arrive during darkness, get all their equipment offloaded and into hangars, and get their transport planes out of there before daylight. They'd be dispersed to other bases in the region, but close enough to react if the teams had to move quickly. As they flew over the Atlantic, Steiner took time to process the latest intelligence information. A picture was taking shape about the challenge they faced. There were 4 heavily armed terrorists, 97 passengers of several nationalities, some of whom were U.S. citizens, and a ship's crew of 344. The ship's location was still unknown. It had gone into radio silence immediately following the hijacking, headed north, and was presumed to be somewhere in the eastern Mediterranean. There was nothing more to be done now. The plans were in place and would be updated as soon as any more information came in. Once they hit the ground, his units would start to put the plans into effect, but for now, it was a rare moment of peace. As the plane vibrated around him, Steiner's thoughts drifted back to what had brought him to this time and place, to all the training and missions that had come before, to the hot and often desolate places he had been. And he thought of the men who had come before him, who had created the kind of warfare in which he was now engaged. Pioneers. Commando raids, deep reconnaissance, sabotage, guerrilla bands, these had all existed as long as men had clashed violently with other men. But what was now called unconventional warfare had not become officially recognized as a proper activity for real soldiers until World War II. During World War II, they wrote the book on special warfare, what we might call the Special Forces Bible. These are some of the more outstanding elements and skills it illustrates. The special soldier can expect to operate in areas deep beyond the official lines of battle, where the zones controlled by one side or the other may be indistinct or even meaningless. Likewise, he may have a hard time telling good guys from bad guys, and the official names or political pedigree of a leader, group, or faction may also not tell him much about who and what he is facing. He can expect to operate in a high-threat, high-stress environment with little or no support from his parent organization. He'll need to be expert in all the basic soldier skills, not only as a military practitioner, but as a teacher. He also needs to be familiar with a wide range of foreign weapons and systems, and he should be expert in various forms of hand-to-hand combat. He needs to be reasonably proficient in the language of the country in which he's operating, and knowledgeable about the culture, political situation, and physical conditions of the people. Since he'll be operating behind the lines, he must be able to live a cover story and handle other aspects of the tradecraft of the secret world. He must have the psychological strength to handle the stresses with which he'll be faced. Living on his own, the absence of support, the inevitable screw-ups of others, inevitably magnified by the absence of support. He must be endowed with considerable resourcefulness, flexibility, and ingenuity. More important, he must demonstrate a high level of psychological, political, and military acuity. He must be able to sell, persuade, cajole, browbeat, and convince people who dislike him, distrust him, and are doing their best to con him. His best weapon in this conflict will often be his ability to do his job so well that his adversary, friend, can't help but come to trust him. The stakes he faces are high. He and his team represent on their own the policies of their country. They will often have to make choices on how to implement these policies with little or no guidance from above. They have to be competent to make the right choices. At the same time, their choices directly affect not only the lives of the guerrillas or partisans with whom they are working, but, perhaps more important, the lives of both innocent and involved civilians. Each of these elements and skills comes more alive within a historical context, which brings us to Colonel Aaron Bank, who became one of the founders of the United States Special Forces. Aaron Bank is on every Green Beret's shortlist of great ones. As a member of the OSS Jedburgh team, Aaron Bank parachuted into the south of France in 1944 and operated in Provence, participating in attacks on strategic enemy facilities and convoys, guidance and instruction of Maquis, and conflicts with communists. Following the liberation of France, Bank, who spoke passable German and who was by then a major, was asked by his OSS superiors to create a special operations company of dissident German soldiers. Their mission? Personally assigned by the legendary general and OSS commander, Wild Bill Donovan himself, was to capture Hitler alive in the event he and his henchmen attempted to barricade themselves in what the Nazis chose to call their national redoubt in the mountains of Bavaria. The European war ended. The redoubt proved to be a myth, and Bank's mission was aborted. Later, Bank was sent by the OSS to Indochina, where, among other things, he spent a pleasant day or two traveling with Ho Chi Minh, as well as several fascinating months increasing his knowledge of people's wars and guerrilla operations. The OSS was disbanded in September 1945, and Bank was brought back, somewhat reluctantly, into the main body of the Army. There he sorely missed the old Jedburgh thrill of always being on the edge of the action, and the Jedburgh freedom of operating on his own behind the lines. Though he knew some traditionalists were uncomfortable with giving people like him so much leash, they called it lax and unmilitary. But he was himself a good soldier and went where he was sent without public complaints. Far more important, he was certain the Army was losing something essential when it did not pick up the capabilities abandoned with the dissolution of the OSS, Jedburgh teams, and operational groups. The latter were teams of 30 men that could be split into two teams of 15, precursors of the 12-man Special Forces aid detachments. During World War II, operational groups were inserted behind the lines in Europe and Asia, primarily Burma, where they performed direct action combat roles, such as sabotage, or linked up with guerrillas and partisans, as the Jedburghs did. Aaron Bank believed that the post-war army required similar units, but ones that were even better trained, equipped, prepared, and staffed. In his view, special operations forces designed to organize, guide, and equip indigenous resistance or guerrilla movements could turn out to be as essential as any of the conventional combat arms in the United States arsenal. In 1947, the CIA was formed, with a mission to recreate the intelligence operations of the OSS. It was also given a covert special operations role to deal with resistance movements and guerrilla organizations. But it was never comfortable with it, even after the creation of the CIA, Bank continued to feel a strong need for the Army to take on the entire task once performed by the Special Operations Branch of the OSS. This conviction was not shared by the majority of the Army. Conventional soldiers tend to see unconventional warfare primarily as a sideshow, peripheral to the real action. That is, regular infantry, airborne, tanks, artillery, and more than a little outrageous. To the orthodox traditional soldier, Bank writes in his memoirs, it was something slimy, underhanded, illegal, and ungentlemanly. It did not fit in the honor code of their profession of arms. Over the years, U.S. soldiers have been especially vulnerable to this attitude. As noted, our Army is traditionally nervous about elites. It's a citizen's army, ordinary folks. Superior soldiers and superior units are welcome, but they aren't expected to call much attention to themselves. Special forces, by their nature, call attention to themselves. A few years later, after the formation of U.S. Special Forces, assignment there was not thought to be a lucky career move. The U.S. Army is no more friendly to oddballs and reformers than it is to elites. It is bound by rules, nervous about innovation, slow to change. Revolutionaries need not apply. Yet, as Aaron Bank knew, the Army is not a monolith. It's a very large house with hundreds of rooms. Reformers aren't exactly encouraged, but smart, politically savvy, courageous men who are patient, do their homework, and are willing to risk their careers, have a shot at making their changes stick, especially if an inspired few others share the dream. Meanwhile, during the years between the dissolution of the OSS and the outbreak of the war in Korea, Bank did his homework. Specifically, he read all he could find about unconventional warfare. What is it? How does it differ from conventional war? What does history say about it? Why do we have operations called special? Unconventional warfare is hard to pin down, but over the years, a working understanding has developed. It is far from complete and is blind to many nuances, but it's not a bad place to start. Unconventional warfare primarily involves operations different from the conventional fires and movement of mass troops, armor, artillery, and air power. Normally, unconventional warfare is performed by small, highly trained units, takes place behind regular lines of battle, and involves such activities as reconnaissance, sabotage, raids, raids in force, assassination, and, above all, the training and support of friendly guerrilla forces. This comes under the overall title of direct action. One prime example of direct action was a blowtorch violent joint United States-Canadian Ranger unit called the 1st Special Service Force, FSSF, that so distinguished itself in World War II that it had been designated an official ancestor of today's Special Forces. The FSSF was formed to make lightning raids on targets such as the Germans' heavy water production facilities in Norway and the Romanian oil fields, but was used primarily to crack through mountain fortifications in Italy, where it took heavy losses. But unconventional, special warfare also has other facets, as every Jedburgh knew. Screwing with your enemy's head is one. Helping people in trouble with medical aid, organizational advice and counsel, assistance in building bridges and roads, and getting clean water is another. Screwing with your enemy's head is called psychological operations, or PSYOPs. In Aaron Bank's day, psychological warfare. Helping people usually comes under the rubric of civil affairs, CA, a tool that's been in the special operations kit nearly as long as PSYOPs. There are many justifications for CA, including simple goodness, but its main military one is this. A population that is friendly to you and has experienced your kindness is not likely to feel kindly to or give help and support to your enemy. The debate has raged over which is the purest model for special units. Larger units such as Rangers and Commandos, which tend more to direct action, or smaller teams such as Jedburghs and aid detachments, which specialize more in teaching and training indigenous forces. Here, as it turns out, purist is a blind alley, and the best answer is all of the above. Historically, there is no clean division between conventional and unconventional wars. The historical roots of both go back equally far. At the time of Jesus, freedom fighters fought a long, drawn-out guerrilla war with the occupying Romans. 1,000 years later, Vikings launched commando-type raids from seas and rivers. During Napoleon's occupation of Spain in the early 19th century, Spanish guerrillas forced the French army to regret their conquest, and Spaniards gave this form of warfare its name. Guerrilla in Spanish means little war. Robin Hood and his men were guerrillas. T.E. Lawrence was a kind of semi-freelance special operations officer, guiding indigenous Arabs in their struggle to break free of an oppressive occupying power. Traditionally, resistance, insurgent, or guerrilla movements spring up from people who are otherwise powerless to gain liberation from foreign occupation, or to gain freedom from their own oppressive or tyrannical government. A prime instance of Karl von Clausewitz's most famous insight in On War, published in 1832, that war is simply another form of politics. Though von Clausewitz's insight had never been lost on the more thoughtful of military men, military planners don't normally give the political aspects of a problem serious consideration when they develop their strategy and tactics. They mostly see civilians as either encumbrances, props, or potential threats. Get the damned civilians out of my way. Recent times have seen a change in these attitudes, a change that is reflected in the currently fashionable expression, end state, as in, what end state do we want and how can we achieve it? End state reflects both the military and political situation hoped for at the end of a conflict. Yet it still remains true that most military leaders do not normally consider how those under their command can affect a political situation that can in turn have a bearing on the outcome of a war. Such is not the case with practitioners of unconventional war. Special soldiers have to be conscious of both the political implications of their military actions and the military implications of political actions. In fact, they have to be conscious of anything they do or say that could have an impact on the people they have been assigned to help and guide. Success lies far beyond the obtaining of military objectives. This is why psychological operations and civic affairs have always been part of the special warfare toolkit. It is also why flexibility, resourcefulness, and political savvy were so important to Aaron Bank and the other Jedbergs. It is also, finally, why governments have come to find more and more uses for military forces that have these and associated capabilities. They are precision instruments, while tanks, artillery, and the other major combat arms are, by comparison, blunt, though far more powerful. To put it another way, special operations are conducted against strategic and operational targets that can't be attacked in any other way. A strategic and operational target generally has to do with the center of gravity of an enemy, another term from Clausewitz. And that center of gravity can be physical, psychological, or economic. If conventional weaponry can't deal with it, special operations can. When a nation finds it has a recurring need for these kinds of forces, then they form them into a special operations branch. During World War II, for example, the British knew they could never slug it out toe-to-toe with the German armies. Their special operations branch was intended to give them a lever that might even up the score. From 1946 to 1951, the Army maintained an interest in rebuilding an unconventional warfare capability and conducted many studies, but not much actually happened. Since there was a Ranger precedent, one study looked at the possibility of starting up a Ranger group that could carry out both a Jedburgh-like teaching and training mission and Ranger-type raids. Another study proposed creating a special operations force using refugee soldiers from Soviet satellite countries in Eastern Europe, many of whom had extensive unconventional warfare experience fighting the Nazis. These men could join up under the provisions of the Lodge Act, which allowed foreigners to join the U.S. military services and, after 2 years, be granted citizenship. It would be a kind of American Special Forces Foreign Legion. Unfortunately, there were at most 3,000 men available for such a unit, which was not enough to do the job, though Lodge Act volunteers later did become a major component of early special forces. Nothing came of any of these proposals. Like all Jedburghs, Aaron Bank had some familiarity with psychological warfare techniques, such as spreading rumors to build up civilian morale or enemy fears, or to spread false information. However, Bank never imagined he himself would be assigned to a psychological warfare unit. He simply was not trained for it. Yet that was what happened early in 1951. Bank, a colonel by then, was with a combat unit in Korea, the 187th Airborne Regimental Combat Team, when he received orders to go back to the States and report to the psychological warfare staff in Washington under Brigadier General Robert McClure. McClure, a remarkable man, had run psychological warfare, more accurately, created it out of nothing, in Europe for Eisenhower and, after the war, had directed the denazification program for the Allied military government in Germany. The outbreak of the Korean War had pointed up to him the necessity for rebuilding a psychological operations capability. As Eisenhower's man in charge of psychological war, McClure had often coordinated his operations with the OSS staff, and had thus come into contact with the OSS Special Operations Branch. He had been impressed with what he saw, and when the time came for him to restart psychological operations, he successfully argued that special operations be included in his team. To that end, McClure teamed Bank with still another remarkable man, a brilliant and highly energetic lieutenant colonel named Russell Volkman. Their job? To bring special operations back into the Army. When the Japanese captured the Philippines during the early days of America's involvement in World War II, Volkman became one of those intrepid Americans who did not surrender. He joined Filipino soldiers and a few other Americans on the island of Luzon in organizing guerrilla resistance to the Japanese. In Bank's words, when General MacArthur said, "I shall return," Volkman, who was then a captain, echoed, "I shall remain, with MacArthur's blessing." After 3 years of fighting, their initially small force had grown to something near 15,000 strong, roughly division strength, and had killed or captured many thousand Japanese. When the moment for the Japanese surrender finally arrived, the Japanese commander, General Yamashita, gave it not to MacArthur, but to the guerrilla force. To honor the guerrilla contribution to victory, MacArthur granted Volkman, now a colonel, a place at the formal surrender table. Bank, Volkman, and McClure pooled their experience in research and sat down to try and resolve the many issues that had long occupied special warfare experts. The Ranger versus Special Operations guerrilla support model, problems of command and control, staff, logistics, and field operations, the question of how to use Lodge Act aliens, and so on. These matters would continue to occupy special warfare experts over the next 5 decades. Meanwhile, the Army itself took the Ranger issue off the table for the time being by deactivating the Ranger units then in existence and setting up a Ranger school where combat and other selected personnel could receive Ranger training and then return to their home units. This was good news to Aaron Bank, who was partial to the OSS and not the Ranger model for special operations. Since the Army still required deep penetration, long-term operations, the deactivation of the Ranger units would free up personnel spaces for them. Shortly thereafter, Bank and Volkman were authorized to put together a table of organization and equipment, T-O-N-E, the final step needed for the creation of a military unit. The questions now were, how did you make military units that would operate flexibly and resourcefully in non-standard situations? How big should the operational teams be? How should they be composed? Bank's preference was to put together a pool of highly trained men who could be formed into units purpose-built for specific missions. For various Army bureaucracy reasons, however, that was not a workable option. Meanwhile, the OSS offered two already proven models, the 3-man Jedburgh team and the 30-man operational groups. Though not as flexible or as stealthy as a Jedburgh team, the OGs were capable of conducting direct action raids against difficult targets far behind the lines, or guerrilla actions in areas where there were no indigenous guerrillas. The ability of OGs to be split into 15-man teams for greater flexibility gave Bank another idea. Why not create a core Special Forces field unit that was somewhat larger and more capable than the small Jedburgh team, but somewhat smaller than the OG direct action strike units. Out of this thought came the Special Forces A Detachment, or A-Team. These were initially 15-man, half-size OGs, but soon turned into the 12-man units of today's Special Forces. A captain commanded, with a lieutenant as his number two, later a warrant officer, while the balance was made up of experienced NCOs. Everyone was to be highly specialized, but for flexibility and redundancy, these specialties were to be paired. There would be two weapons specialists, two communication specialists, two medics, and so on. Everyone would also be cross-trained, not as specialists, but able to handle the other jobs in a pinch. Everyone was also to be airborne and ranger qualified, and in the early days, a few people on the teams could speak fluently the language of the country in which the team would operate. Later, every Special Forces soldier received extensive and very high-level language and cultural training. The A detachment was, and is, a tiny unit, which did not by itself throw a lot of firepower, but it jammed into a diminutive package a lot of rank and experience. It was also a highly flexible arrangement. Cut one in two, and you had something very close to a Jedburgh team. Put two A detachments together, and you had an OG. The A detachment would operate in the field somewhere in a target country. A B detachment, usually commanded by a major, assisted by two other officers and nine NCOs, would run three A detachments, usually from some central location such as a major town or regional capital. A C detachment, with the same complement of officers and NCOs, would run three Bs, usually from the target country's national capital. The C was to be commanded by a lieutenant colonel, who would have a major as his executive officer. Three Cs made a group, which was commanded by a colonel. The groups had, and still have, a regional orientation. The Special Forces mission, as defined by the TONE, read in essence, to infiltrate by air, sea, or land deep into enemy-controlled territory, and to stay, organize, equip, train, control, and direct the indigenous potential in the conduct of Special Forces operations. Special Forces operations were defined as the organization of resistance movements and operation of their component networks, conduct of guerrilla warfare, field intelligence gathering, espionage, sabotage, subversion, and escape and evasion activities. All these people would need a place to lay their heads and space for offices, classes, and training. They also needed a center where special operations and unconventional warfare theory and practice, policy and doctrine, and techniques and tactics could be studied, debated, and developed. If Aaron Bank and Russell Volkman had had their wish, there would have been a facility dedicated to this purpose, a special warfare center and school. However, since Special Forces were for the time being a component of the psychological warfare branch, the Special Warfare Center and school would have to start out as an adjunct to a projected psychological warfare center, which Brigadier General McClure planned for Fort Bragg, North Carolina. This center was approved in March 1952. It was to be temporarily under Banks' command. He would also, more permanently, become commander of the first unit to be activated, the 10th Special Forces Group, which was to have a European focus. Next came recruiting, which in the early days was aimed at airborne troops, rangers, and Lodge Act volunteers. The Green Berets still aimed their recruiting primarily at airborne and ranger forces. On June 19, 1952, Bank activated the unit and assumed command. "Present for duty," he writes, "were seven enlisted men, one warrant officer, and me, making a slim morning report." The numbers quickly grew. Later that year, the 10th Group was moved to Bad Tölz, south of Munich in Germany, but not before it was split in two. The half that stayed behind became the newly organized 77th Special Forces Group. McClure, Bank, and Volkman, together with many, many others who'd helped, advised, and supported them, had well and truly launched U.S. Special Forces. It was, however, still a small and, yes, peripheral organization in those days, until the day in 1961 when the U.S. Special Forces had its defining moment. Warrior's Warrior. That defining moment took place on October 12, 1961, at the Rod and Gun Club near McKellar's Pond at Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Present that day were the new Special Forces Commander, the recently promoted Brigadier General Bill Yarborough, President John F. Kennedy's military aide, Major General Chester V. Ted Clifton, President Kennedy himself, and assorted other dignitaries. Kennedy had ostensibly come down to Fort Bragg for two purposes. One was to observe an Army division, the 82nd Airborne, drawn up on Simmons Airfield with guidons, flying, and all of its supporting weapons and equipment. Clifton had felt the young president would benefit from watching an entire Army division spread out before him. The other reason, however, was the real purpose of the trip, as Clifton, the president, and Bill Yarborough were well aware. It was to let Kennedy experience what special forces could do. Kennedy was already favorably inclined toward special operations. In his eyes, they were glamorous, and Kennedy was always favorably inclined toward glamour. But far more important to him, special forces had the potential to do things that he very badly wanted done. Back then, Kennedy had a vision that few of the nation's leaders shared. He saw the likelihood that the United States would soon find itself entangled in a new kind of conflict that would pose a new kind of threat. In his words, "We faced another type of war than we were used to, one that challenged our normal ways of waging war, new in its intensity, ancient in its origins, war by guerrillas, subversives, insurgents, assassins, war by ambush instead of by combat, by infiltration instead of by aggression, seeking victory by eroding and exhausting the enemy instead of engaging him. It requires, in those situations where we must encounter it, a whole new kind of strategy, a wholly different kind of force." A vivid, exciting, and properly staged Special Forces show, Clifton and Yarborough agreed, would surely demonstrate for their commander-in-chief that the Army already possessed the kind of soldier and force needed to prevail in this new arena. It was far from fully formed and developed. No one would deny that. But Yarborough thought he could demonstrate that he had the core needed to build it. As an added boon that day, for the first time at an official function, the Special Forces troops wore their far from official but much cherished headgear, the Green Beret. At that time, wearing Green Berets as an item of uniform was strictly forbidden. The Army of the 1960s did not allow a distinctive uniform for elite troops like Special Forces or paratroopers. The name of the game was uniformity and homogenization. Even so, all Special Forces troops kept a Green Beret somewhere and wore it on field maneuvers in remote areas, or when no one who could do anything about it was looking. Bill Yarborough and Ted Clifton had been classmates and close friends at West Point and remained lifetime friends. Before Kennedy's trip to Fort Bragg, Clifton and Yarborough had debated the wearing of the beret for the president. On the downside, they were putting their military careers at risk. On the upside, they felt that the Special Forces needed to be recognized as extraordinary by their military colleagues and the public. To Yarborough, a man profoundly sensitive to symbols, the beret was not simply a distinctive piece of clothing, but an emblem. "I think the president would like to see your guys in their green berets," said Clifton. "So do I," Yarborough replied. "But, of course, they're not authorized." "Well," Clifton said, "you tell them to come out wearing it. What happens after that?" "Whatever it is, we'll fix it." And so on the 12th of October, 1961, green berets of a grand variety of shades and textures, some of them veterans of dozens of field exercises, emerged from every kind of hiding place. The men wearing them that day stood proud in a way they had never been allowed before, and the smiling young president was delighted. Later, even as the Uniform Board of the Army tried to grapple with this outrage, a telegram from the White House came to Brigadier General Yarborough, indicating that the president had given his approval to the beret as a symbol of excellence. From that moment on, the Green Beret was officially sanctioned. Since then, berets of many varieties have become official headgear for the U.S. Army units. First, for recognized elites such as Rangers, Black Berets, and paratroopers, Red Maroon. More recently, amid considerable controversy, the entire Army has been given the privilege of wearing black berets. The Rangers will now wear tan. Be that as it may, the wearing of the berets was not the main event back on that warm autumn day 40 years ago. The main event was the Gabriel demonstration, named after a special forces soldier named Gabriel. Though the name's associations with the announcing angel Gabriel were not forgotten. The idea was to display the variety, flexibility, and resourcefulness of the A detachments as played off against some of the more significant challenges they might be expected to face. Normally, they would have taken the president around to various locations where the teams were in action. But that would not work here, partly because of the nature of special forces, which operate in widely separated areas and in clandestine and covert situations, making observation difficult. But mostly, Ted Clifton informed Yarrowborough beforehand because Kennedy's bad back didn't allow him much movement. Instead of bringing the president to the show, they would have to bring the show to the president. To that end, Clifton and Yarrowborough worked out a system in which Special Forces skill groups would pass a reviewing stand on floats, or using floats as props, mounted on flatbed trucks. Each one would stop in front of the president, and that element's activities would be revealed. There was little emphasis on equipment, gear, and weapons. The emphasis was on people. One float, for example, showed an enemy guerrilla base like those in Laos, South Vietnam, and elsewhere in Southeast Asia. Such bases were hard to find, fix, or destroy, since they moved in fluid fashion and were concealed in swamps, jungles, or mountain hideaways. Finding and destroying such bases, the president was told, required highly trained, specially equipped, light mobile combat units. Special Forces aid detachments could perform in these roles, but more appropriately, they could train others to do so. Another float showed how the language and cultural training possessed by aid detachment troops allowed them to train and assist native forces. Another showed how Special Forces civic actions, such as medical help, supplemented their combat functions, benefited ordinary folks who might otherwise help the bad guys, and helped drain away the seas where enemy guerrillas swam. Others showed Special Forces psychological and communication skills by broadcast, loudspeakers in villages, or leaflets. Thousands of leaflets fell out of the sky that day to reinforce the point. Others showed more traditional special operations, such as training friendly guerrillas to operate against enemy convoys and supply dumps deep within enemy territory. The show worked. Shortly thereafter, presidential approval came for a much larger Special Forces, more groups, more men, and much more money. The show Yarrowborough and Clifton put on for the president that October day was really the culmination of three entwined, but not at the same time, totally recognized or understood forces. First, and he did not know this, Bill Yarrowborough had been handpicked by Kennedy for the command of Special Forces with help and advice from Ted Clifton. The president had told the Army Chief of Staff that he wanted Yarrowborough, so Yarrowborough he got. This token of executive preference was inevitably resented by those guys there at the Pentagon, who liked to be in charge of picking who went where. They didn't like it when the president took that power away from them, and this meant that Yarrowborough started with strikes against him. Second, Bill Yarrowborough knew that Special Forces was the only U.S. military concept oriented toward the new form of warfare that so worried the president. But he also knew that this would be a very tough sell to the Army without Kennedy's help. The Army had continued to fight World War II, a firepower and massed forces war, for decades after that war was won. It meant that Yarrowborough would have to sail close to the wind in order to promote and sell Special Forces. He would have to convince the president and the American public. As Ted Clifton had known well when he passed Yarrowborough's name to Kennedy, Yarrowborough was a master promoter. Showbiz, to his friends, he was the man for the job. Third, and this is the primary reason why that October day was Special Forces' defining moment. Now that he had been empowered by his commander-in-chief, Bill Yarrowborough began to transform Special Forces, making it over in his own image. Yarrowborough was a creature of many dimensions, and that was what Special Forces became. In leaving that legacy, he proved through his genius, his vision, and his actions that the Clifton-Kennedy laying on of hands that had brought him to Fort Bragg was the correct choice. Before Yarrowborough, U.S. Special Forces had been a career backwater. The special forces that exist today, with the help of hundreds of other great men, are largely his creation. In the beginning, Yarborough had been far from pleased to take on the special forces job, but he soon began to see what John Kennedy already knew, that a new kind of force was needed to fight a new kind of war. Aaron Banks' special forces had preserved in amber his vision of the OSS and Jedburgh World War II glory days. What was needed now was to transform the soldiers that Aaron Bank and Volkmann had trained to rampage behind the lines into fighting men who were far more highly skilled, imaginative, flexible, culturally sensitive, and resourceful. Yarborough produced men capable of handling missions that were far more complex than those he had encountered as an intelligence officer in Europe, and doing so with style, finesse, and precisely focused force, when necessary. John Kennedy's thoughts on unconventional warfare were a response to very real worries back in the 1950s and 60s, the seemingly relentless and insidious spread of the communist empire and the sudden collapse of colonialism. Colonialism, the rule by Western powers over third world peoples for the sake of their economic exploitation, had lasted several centuries. Its death, except in the Soviet version, took approximately 2 decades. The years following the end of the Second World War. Sadly, the departure of the old colonial masters brought few blessings to the newly independent Third World nations. The old masters left behind very few capable indigenous leaders and very little for them to work with. The white man's burden was a never-delivered promise. In most newly decolonized Third World nations, the infrastructures necessary to maintain a society as a going concern were lacking. Transportation, education, health care, banks and investment, and most of all, enforceable laws and an effective justice system to protect them. More often than not, the emerging third world leaders were primarily interested in personal aggrandizement and wealth, rather than in the long, hard toil needed to build a viable nation. The citizens of those nations, meanwhile, wanted what everybody else wants, better lives for themselves and their children. We've thrown the old masters out, they argued, sensibly, and often after long, hard struggles, pain, and sacrifice. Now we deserve to see the fruits of our victory. When the fruits didn't immediately appear, and in fact seemed to recede ever farther into a future ever more squalid and rotten with corruption, it's not hard to imagine their dismay, nor to see how quickly their mood turned nasty. Naturally, this potentially explosive situation became a major arena in the battle between the communist powers and the West. At stake were power and influence over a great part of the world's population, as well as control over a vast wealth of natural resources. The more ideologically driven communists started out with a number of advantages in this contest. They had no link with the old discredited colonial powers, and they promised heaven on earth, and soon. The Chinese, in particular, had also developed effective techniques for transforming the dismay, discontent, and rage against the failed or failing third world governments into mechanisms that seriously threatened those systems. The Western powers, the United States in particular as their leader, started fighting with serious disadvantages. Communism represented the bright and shiny future. The democracies and capitalism represented the discredited past. Nor were the democracies especially skillful in the psyops part of the struggle. Democratic capitalism and the rule of law, adapted to the cultural requirements and traditions of each society, remains the best hope for most of the world's people. The West did not do a very good job selling that truth. Meanwhile, Mao Zedong's victory in China showed the way for others. Dismay and discontent can be transformed into dissent and dissidence. Dissidents can be transformed into subversion and terrorism. Subversion and terrorism can be transformed into active insurrection. Insurrection can be transformed into guerrilla war. And in time, guerrilla war can be transformed into conventional military action. But only when the guerrillas feel totally confident that the outcome favors them. Each stage in the process supports actions aimed at exploiting the ruling system's weaknesses. The aim is not direct confrontation, but to cause a rotting from within. Agents corrupt or turn politicians. Other agents take over labor unions, student groups, farmers' collectives. They infiltrate the media, the military, and the police, all as vehicles for propaganda and subversion. The revolutionaries do not expect to destroy the system in a single blow or series of blows. Any weakness will do. Economic, political, psychological, physical. In fact, the greatest vulnerability of any system is often psychological. Will. As a result, eroding the will of the enemy to continue the struggle is always a chief aim of the underground opposition. This can take a very long time, years, even decades. The subversive leadership, as Mao has taught, must always remain patient. It follows that each stage is supported by the ones before it, and each stage remains active even as new ones arise. At the same time, the various elements and stages of the subversive underground are protected from detection by means of a complex cell structure. Chop off a finger, but the body remains, and a new finger grows. It follows as well that all these elements depend on near flawless intelligence, and on the whole, they get it. Their eyes are everywhere. They know whatever the people know. It follows, finally, that the more active stages depend almost totally on the support of the people, for supplies, intelligence, money, and recruits. Very often, this support comes at great risk and considerable cost. The governing bodies, like the Germans in occupied France, look for payback opportunities, or else simply for ways to send a strong message. The more threatened they become, the more likely they are to flail about violently, to the psychological advantage of the revolution. Of course, standing up under such assaults requires strong, highly motivated people. From this comes Mao's famous sea and fish image. The people are the sea. The revolutionaries are the fish. The sea supports the fish. It also hides them from predators. The revolutionaries only want to show themselves when they are not themselves vulnerable. Then they fade back into the sea, or the mountains, or the jungle. Of course, the revolutionaries almost always received support from one or another communist power. It was a war by proxy. Meanwhile, all too often, third world leaders sold their services to the highest bidder, or to whichever bidder was handy at the moment. This was President Kennedy's new kind of war. It went under many names: revolution, people's war, subterranean war, multidimensional war, slow burn war, war in the shadows. All of these names were useful and described a significant aspect of the struggle. The focus on concealment and complexity, however, points to a hard but basic truth. The old way of fighting wars simply did not work. You couldn't just send in the cavalry or an armored corps. You could bomb a people back into the Stone Age and their children would come out of their holes, throw stones and vanish back into the holes. Where's the enemy? Who are we actually fighting? When we take a piece of territory, do we hold anything worth holding? The president had it right. A new kind of fighting force was required. This force had to know guerrillas inside and out, how they lived, how they fought, how they swam in the sea of the people. The Bank Volkmann McClure Special Forces had no problems there. But skill at behind-the-line sabotage and running around with guerrillas was far from enough. For the early special forces, guerrillas and partisans were expected to be our friends. A reorientation was needed when guerrillas became our enemies. It wasn't a gigantic reorientation, but attitudes had to change and new skills had to be learned. For one thing, you couldn't begin to uproot guerrillas without at the same time understanding and attacking the shadowy mechanisms that spawned and sustained them, the vast network of subversion, terror, support, and intelligence. But doing so without utterly wiping out the very freedoms that the United States was trying to preserve and promote was a daunting task. Nor was it easy to go into somebody else's home and set their house in order. Sovereign states consider internal subversion a very touchy matter. They are not eager to give foreigners access to the mechanisms that support it. In fact, the governments of these states are often themselves diseased. The cure proposed by the revolutionaries may well be the wrong cure, yet their cause may be just. This meant that if American special forces were going to do any good at all in a counterinsurgency situation, they would have to be able to walk a very thin and risky line. They would have to act toward the local government with great care and finesse, based on the direction they'd been given by their own commanders and government, while developing more than a skin-deep rapport with the native peoples. In view of this very sensitive psychological and political environment, it became evident to Bill Yarborough that the criteria for special forces would have to include far more than just expertise in guerrilla warfare. Personal character became extremely important. The judgment, maturity, self-discipline, and ability to work harmoniously with people who were culturally very different from Americans. What kind of soldier operates effectively in such an environment? First of all, and this is as true now as it was in 1961, it is one who thinks in ways that conventional soldiers are not expected to. Like all soldiers, Special Forces men work under a chain of command. But unlike the others, they may not always have direct or even regular communication with their superiors. That means that at times they need to act on their own, which means they inevitably make decisions on their own, though based, it is hoped, on a clear understanding of their commanders and their nation's intent. At times, these decisions have an impact far greater than those that more conventional soldiers may be called on to make. They may not only radically change lives or lead to deaths, they may also affect policy decisions going all the way up the chain of command to the president. At the same time, tough problems come up that only Special Forces soldiers can solve. Many of these problems are practical. A Special Forces soldier might be required to deliver babies, extract teeth, or design a bridge and supervise its construction. Others are psychological. Special Forces soldiers may well need to persuade, cajole, or manipulate a not very friendly local leader to work for goals that may be in the United States' interest, but not obviously in his. Either way, the problems are typically unexpected, complex, and open-ended, and there is no guarantee of help from above. In addition, Special Forces soldiers cannot focus their individual tactics, techniques, capabilities, and thinking on a few specifics. They can't simply rely on well-honed soldier skills. They are taught and are expected to think in the broadest terms. When they work a problem, they are not merely trying to solve it in the best way for their team, but in the best way for the United States. They need to be able to see and handle such problems in all their complexity. Soldiers are called special in part because they can be trusted to make decisions. Empowered though he was by the president to make those soldiers, Bill Yarborough had a big job ahead of him. He had to take the old Special Forces and turn it into the new Special Forces, and not all of the old wanted to become new. He had to grow the small and marginal outfit into a force of significant size with greatly increased output, yet bring into the force the very best recruits. This meant raiding the rest of the Army for people nobody in the rest of the Army was willing to give up. He was empowered to do so, but at the cost of much resentment. He had to weed out those who did not make the mark, while educating and training to the very highest standards the picked and tested men who remained. And then he had to fill these men, individually and collectively, with pride and self-esteem. Meanwhile, he had to study the nature of the enemy and the ways others had learned to combat such an enemy. He had to do it to a depth rarely, if ever, accomplished by a military organization. And he had to find ways to make his special forces not just learn these insights, but incorporate them into their blood and sinews. And finally, he had to continue to sell his always fragile and vulnerable special forces to the big army and to the American people. Bill Yarborough faced a big job, but first he had to clean house, which involved raising the bar. Not long after he took over Special Forces in 1961, Yarborough came to realize that a significant portion of the SF old-timers did not measure up to the standards his new fighting force required. These old guys were a rough lot, fire breathers and flame spouters. They were extraordinary soldiers, but not all of them could be counted on to operate well in politically and psychologically sensitive situations. Some of the old SF guys were a rough lot off duty as well as on, and that presented Yarborough with yet more problems. Because Special Forces was a marginal outfit where promotions were scarce, the best officers tended to avoid the assignment if they could. In those days, the level of SF training for officers was also low. The qualification course, for example, could be waived for field-grade officers, and often was. For various reasons, the future for good Special Forces NCOs was brighter, and NCO quality tended to be higher. The NCO's expertise also tended to be high, Many of them were World War II and or Korea veterans with considerable experience in the field, and most had been shot at. And Yarborough wanted to make the most of their expertise in teaching his younger soldiers. But they also tended to act as though they had carte blanche to do things pretty much as they pleased. They tended to run a bit wild when they were out there with the younger guys. They had to be reined in. The officers, though, were a bigger problem. There were outstanding exceptions, but too many officers looked at the assignment as a place to park and have macho fun, drinking, wild parties, womanizing, playing around with other guys' wives. That had to stop. Early on in his command, Yarborough took his officers, captain and higher, out into the pine woods on the base and told them straight what he expected of them. He was not gentle. "As long as I'm in charge of special forces," he told them, "the rules are going to change. There'll be a new start. First, there will be no womanizing, no drunkenness, no wild parties, no adultery. There'll be no troublemakers, no wild men. From now on, all that stuff is out, and there will be no deviations. There will be moral standards. There will be disciplinary standards. There will be appearance standards. Second, all officers will go through the Q course, no exceptions, no matter what his rank. Third, everything I'm saying applies to all ranks, no exceptions. So you're going to make it all clear to every one of your NCOs. Finally, if you don't like it, you can deal with it in two ways. You can end your career, or you can come to my office and request to be transferred out. Otherwise, if you want to stay in this unit, there will be big changes." The worst got out, the best stayed, and Yarborough moved on to the real work that remained. Meanwhile, Special Forces officers and NCOs began to find promotions coming their way. If you got into Special Forces and you could cut it, you could expect to get promoted very quickly and look forward to a long Army career if you wanted it. So Special Forces stopped being the end of the road for wild men, misfits, and has-beens. It became the place you wanted to be. It was the place where the action was. Soon after the Kennedy administration had identified counterinsurgency as an official instrument of United States foreign policy, it became clear that some of the major weapon systems needed for counterinsurgency would have to be forged from among the resources specific to the behavioral and social sciences: psychology, anthropology, political science, economics, history, and international relations. The problem would be to integrate these disciplines with more direct military functions to produce an effective instrument in the murky environment of actual counterinsurgency campaigns. The Special Warfare Center had to explore this new field. Bill Yarborough was himself a scholar and an intellectual, and his experience in intelligence and counterintelligence had taught him a great deal about how to go about understanding one's adversaries and one's friends. He knew where and how to look for sources of knowledge and inspiration. He went first to Roger Hilsman, who had already played a major role at the State Department and White House in promoting the concept of counterinsurgency and the convoluted world of irregular warfare. Hilsman came down to the Special Warfare Center on several occasions and provided Yarborough and his staff and students with background information and insights. Yarborough and his staff also studied positive and negative examples. Positive in the case of the British, whose triumph in Malaya pointed the way toward a workable counterinsurgency doctrine. A combination of sophistication about native cultures and a willingness to be uncompromisingly brutal in infiltrating local insurgency and then uprooting them from the people. Negative in the case of the French defeat in Indochina and their phony victory in Algeria. Others who regularly gave him counsel included experts like Charles M. Thayer, the head of the United States military mission to Yugoslavia during World War II, and who later headed the Voice of America, Dr. J. Zawadny, then professor of political science at the University of Pennsylvania, who had fought with the Polish underground in Warsaw during the Second World War, and later authored numerous works on irregular warfare and psychological operations, and several others of equal expertise. Some of the sources consulted and studied were controversial. Yarborough was not afraid to shock his students. Conventional thinking was not going to get the job done. One controversial source of insight on irregular warfare was a larger-than-life Air Force colonel named Edward Lansdale. Yarborough writes, "Ed Lansdale made me understand the relationship between what we clumsily call civic action and the ability of a regular army to function among the people. This insight was responsible, to a great degree, for the effectiveness of the counterinsurgency operation in the Philippines. It made the people feel that the military were not oppressors. Rather, the man in uniform represented the government. And if they were eager to assist and help the people, then the government must be of the same frame of mind. The good acts of the men in uniform argued to the benevolence, right intentions, and honor of the government." Later on in my research, he continues, "I discovered that Ed Lansdale was not the author of this concept, but Mao Tse-tung. Mao was the greatest modern proponent of this philosophy." In studying Mao's campaigns leading to the expulsion of Chiang Kai-shek from mainland China, I found that in the beginning the nationalist armies were very much greater numerically than the communist forces. But as Mao withdrew along the route of his long march, his soldiers treated people very generously and kindly and with great respect. And so instead of fleeing to get out of the way of the communists, in the normal way of civilians and armies, the people welcomed them. This behavior goes back to Mao's 9 rules of conduct, which his Red Army troops were made to memorize. They were even set to music and sung daily. These rules were strictly enforced. A man who violated them was severely punished, perhaps executed. Here's an example. "There shall be no confiscations whatever from the poor peasantry. If you borrow anything, return it. Replace all articles you damage. Pay for everything that you purchase. Be honest in all transactions with the peasants. Be courteous and polite to the people and help them when you can." This meant practically, Yarborough continues, that the ordinary rules soldiers were used to in the field did not apply. Civilians were not kicked out if they got in the way. A soldier was encouraged to share his last crust of bread with a peasant. If a door was taken off a house for a soldier to sleep on, the custom in China, it would be replaced before the troops left. The best place for a gun position might be in the center of a tomb. Even so, the Red Army would respect the people and place the gun somewhere else. In consequence, the Red Army swelled, while Chiang Kai-shek's forces lost the confidence of ever greater numbers of people. Careful study of Mao, as well as other communist authorities such as Che Guevara and the Vietnamese Vo Nguyen Giap and Truong Chinh, rounded out further the picture of multidimensional warfare. Their brand of irregular warfare, Yarborough studies revealed, featured the following ingredients: patience to withstand protracted conflict, political awareness on the part of all ranks, intensive wooing of all the little people to the side of the insurgent, the weakening of the enemy's morale by constant propaganda and terrorist harassment, constant offensive action against enemy personnel and sensitive points, but only when tactical advantage is on the side of the irregulars, the avoidance of pitched battles with equal or superior forces, defense only when it is essential to survival or to aid another element to withdraw, the consideration of the enemy's supply system as your own, making him haul the material to dumps, then seizing it from him, constant striving to grow undercover forces into regular forces, ones capable of meeting the enemy on his own ground when the time and circumstances make victory certain. With these studies as a guide, the new direction of special forces became clear. If their job was to teach armed forces of a threatened nation how to combat a local insurgency, then their first task there was to demonstrate carefully thought out and executed military and non-military actions that would allow those forces to win and maintain the support of the people. All of this would require the highest level of discipline on the part of not only the Green Berets, but also the local forces. Such discipline would ensure a high level of conduct and moral behavior among the people in politically sensitive areas. Though conventional soldiers don't normally concern themselves with the civilians who find themselves caught up in the tides of war, when it became obvious that the political and psychological fallout from this lack of concern could negate a brilliant battlefield victory, military leaders had to seriously adjust their thinking. In the U.S. Army, the Special Forces were the first to be taught this lesson officially and put it into practice as a principle of war. Before long, Green Berets, using an American version of Mao's Rules for Conduct, began to have a powerful impact on the lives of little people in third world nations living in remote, often jungle areas. Previously, such people did not much figure in the overall scheme of military maneuver, and for their part, the little people tended to be suspicious of foreign soldiers in their midst. However, a combination of personal qualities and soldier skills soon began to increase cooperation and mutual trust, and these came to grow into admiration and friendship. The Green Berets paid attention to all kinds of little things that other soldiers rarely cared about. For example, they helped a villager increase his water supplies by showing him a simple well-digging technique. They showed him how to dig an irrigation ditch. They gave him seeds that grew into better vegetables than he had ever imagined possible. But strangest and most heartwarming of all, they paid attention to the villager as an individual. They could speak to him in his own dialect, maybe not fluently, but enough. And they shared the lives of the village people. They ate their food and drank their drink. They sat around their fires in the evening and chatted with them. They slept in huts like theirs. Once friendship had been established, the military task of defending the village began. Green Berets traced village fortification outlines, and villagers placed row on row of sharpened stakes in the ground, angled toward approach routes. With Green Beret help, they dug protective shelters inside the village perimeters. They set up an alarm system using an old tire rim or an empty artillery shell case to warn of attack. During all this time, Green Berets worked alongside the villagers, and when attack came, they fought side by side with them. Green Beret aid detachments have always featured medical expertise, two highly trained medical specialists, with each of the remaining eight troopers cross-trained in medical skills. The justification for this expertise came out of the original Special Forces mission, which was to organize and train guerrilla and insurgent forces. During their early days, guerrillas are exceedingly vulnerable. To protect themselves while they grow in strength, they must hide in difficult-to-reach areas such as jungles, swamps, or rugged mountains. Under such conditions, day-to-day survival is often a triumph in itself. If a guerrilla is sick or wounded, he has no outside help on which to rely. Here is where Green Beret medical skills enter the picture. Green Beret medics could provide the medical knowledge to keep guerrillas going as functioning fighters. Those skills were put to similar use in the villages, which were scarcely less isolated than the guerrilla bases, and provided an even more reason for friendship and trust. Often for the first time, villagers had access to basic dental care, prenatal care, antibiotics, vaccinations, and nutrition and disease prevention advice. Training for these missions was intense, difficult, and as realistic as possible. Green Berets returning from foreign missions were sucked dry of information, and they helped train the men replacing them. Replicas of villages were constructed, accurate to the finest detail. In order to prepare for a mission, the Berets lived exactly as they expected to live in the field. Food, shelter, work, language, everything. As a training aide, Yarborough had a portion of a Vietnamese guerrilla village constructed at Fort Bragg, complete to artifacts, livestock, and escape tunnels. On one of his later trips to Vietnam, Yarborough was both amused and gratified to find a replica of his replica village being used by the Vietnamese Army at their infantry training center. Bill Yarborough's devotion to intense special forces preparation also included uncommon, for the Army, attention to specialized personal equipment, such as clothing, medical kits, and rations. Predictably, the big Army monolith had a hard time handling this. They cast an ever colder eye on the oddball operation in North Carolina with its presidential favor, its substantial funding. What they get, I lose. The military has always operated in a zero-sum mode, and it's licensed to raid the best units for their best men, especially their best NCOs, and take them out of the Army, as one four-star general put it. Generals, as generals will, began to murmur among themselves against the Green Beret upstarts and Bill Yarborough's private army. The talk never became public, but a consensus was building in favor of the tried and true. They've been feeding soldiers Laotian food down there at Fort Bragg. What the hell for? Firepower wins wars, not lousy food. Or more generally,
They're going their own way down there. They don't respect the rules. They do things their way and not the Army way.
Some of these charges were not without substance. Though Yarborough never actually broke regulations, he bent them. And where there were holes, he slipped through them. A strict interpretation of regulations would not have been kind to him. In his defense, he was never dishonest. When you have to improvise, you almost inevitably find yourself slipping between rules. In fact, it's hard to imagine how else to build an organization the rules never foresaw. The negative currents came to a head soon after John Kennedy's assassination. General H.K. Johnson, the Army's very conventional-minded new chief of staff, was one of those generals who simply did not understand the new breed of soldier. He was terribly bothered by what Yarborough was doing. He was just getting away with too much. Johnson's solution? He had to show Bill Yarborough who was the boss. The Army had several layers between Yarborough and the President. In Johnson's view, Yarborough had ignored them. Johnson was, in fact, a good and honorable man, and a hero. He'd been a Japanese prisoner during World War II. Before he moved, he visited Yarborough's operation, and he left very impressed. "I'll tell you," Johnson told another general friend, "he's put together a heck of a fighting team." Even so, Yarborough had to go. And besides, he had been on the job for 4 years. It was time to move on. By then, Yarborough had gotten his second star as Major General, and he was sent to Korea, where he represented the UN command as the senior member of the Military Armistice Commission at Panmunjom. There, he dealt with the North Korean and Chinese negotiators in a way that only his experience in special forces could have prepared him for. The job called not only for negotiating skills, but also for psyops and propaganda skills. Most observers called him the toughest negotiator the communists faced at Panmunjom. From Korea, he served at the Pentagon, where his most important job was to run Army intelligence. His official title was Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence. He was later, in 1966, promoted to Lieutenant General and given command of 1st Corps Group in Korea. And then in 1969, he moved on to Hawaii as Chief of Staff and Deputy Commander-in-Chief of U.S. Army Pacific. He retired in 1971 after 36 years of active service. During Bill Yarborough's tenure as Commander of Special Forces, his Green Berets not only carried out their mission in Southeast Asia, but were also active in a number of other parts of the world. From a base in Panama, several teams were sent to the countries of Central and South America, always at the invitation of those countries. In Colombia, for example, 10 years of insurgency called La Violencia had yielded something like 300,000 deaths. Green Berets and Colombian security officials worked together to produce the first comprehensive plan, based on civic action to help the local economy, health, and education to deal with the terror. Though Colombia was to suffer from later terrors, La Violencia ended. Green Berets in Arctic gear worked their way by dog sled, snow weasel, and airplane around the northernmost perimeter of the United States, bringing medical and dental care and planning skills. Other Green Beret teams worked in the Pacific on islands of the American Trust territories, building roads, schoolhouses, and recreational facilities. Others worked in the Philippines. Still others worked in Ethiopia and Congo, later Zaire, later Congo again. When Bill Yarborough took command of Special Forces in 1961, he presided over 4 years of metamorphosis and explosive growth, and left as a major general. No matter how often and how badly he'd ruffle the feathers of his superiors fighting for his beloved Green Berets, his career had prospered. During those 4 years of ferment, a great many warriors joined the now-transformed U.S. Special Forces. One of them was a young captain named Carl Steiner. It is now time for his story. Country Carl. Carl Steiner grew up on a 100-acre farm in rural northeast Tennessee, 8 miles from the nearest town, La Follette. In the 1930s and 40s, the divide between town and country in that part of the world was vast. The main roads were paved. The rest were dirt or gravel. There were occasional trips to town, but people still mostly shopped in country stores. There were few cars and electricity was scarce, finally reaching the Steiner farm in 1948. People made their own entertainment. For boys, most of that was outdoors, hunting or hiking in the nearby Cumberland Mountains, and swimming or fishing in Norris Lake, the big TVA project built in 1936. It was a God and country-loving community. Everybody went to mostly Baptist churches on Sunday, and every able-bodied young man served his country. A bus line ran twice a day between La Follette and nearby Middlesboro, Kentucky. Steiner still had vivid memories of looking out across the fields at age 6 or 7 and watching older boys walk toward the highway to catch the bus to the induction center in La Follette during World War II. Whether they'd been drafted or volunteered, they all went. Later, he listened with respect as the returning boys, now men, recounted their combat experiences, the dread discomfort and pain, but the fun, too, and the joy of parades through newly liberated towns. The sacrifices had a purpose that even a 10-year-old could recognize. When the time came, he knew he owed his country no less service than these men had given. Carl Steiner remembers his family this way. Starting in 1936, my father worked as a diamond drill operator and powder man for the Tennessee Valley Authority, constructing Norris Dam as well as some of the other TVA dams that were built in the 30s and 40s. By the time the war started, he already had several children, which meant he was not drafted, but was instead taken into service for the construction of the Oak Ridge Nuclear Plant, a few miles from La Follette. When he was not building dams and nuclear plants, my father farmed, but during the war, Oak Ridge took precedence. The plant was started in 1942, though its existence was not officially known until President Truman announced production of the atomic bomb in August 1945. It was a crash program, and security was very tight. The facility was protected by a high cyclone fence, armed security guards patrolled on horses, and construction workers had to live like army forces in a barracks on the plant complex. Occasionally, my father would come home on the weekends. When he was away, my mother, Hassie Steiner, supervised the farm and took care of the family. I was the oldest of 5, 3 other brothers and a sister, and my paternal grandparents also lived with us. We all worked hard. Counting leased land, we farmed about 200 acres, raising tobacco, grain crops, and cattle. And that was before tractors. About the time one of the boys turned 6, he went to the fields to work. And during the growing season, when we weren't at school, we worked sun up to sundown 6 days a week. It was hard, but our life was not harsh. There was time off on Sunday for church, friends, and play. There was also plenty to enjoy up in the mountains. They called it hiking these days. We called it climbing. Cave formations, waterfalls, spectacular views, and the Copperheads were an ever-present but exciting challenge. Nearby Norris Lake always beckoned for swimming, boating, and fishing. In season, we went hunting. My dad was a superb hunter, and he always owned a pair of splendid bird dogs. From the time I was old enough to recognize what a shotgun was for, I wanted to go with him. He started letting me do it about the time I started to help him work the farm. Not that I was old enough or big enough to carry a gun or shoot, but I could stalk thickets and brush piles and flush birds out, and I could learn weapon safety from him as well as all his hunting tricks. I was 13 when I was given my first shotgun. It was a single shot, and I couldn't load it until a dog was actually pointing. That way I'd have a chance at hitting the bird, but wasn't otherwise dangerous. If I missed the bird, my dad still had time to shoot it himself. When I was older and had learned everything he felt I needed to know about hunting, I was allowed out on my own. It was a great time and place to be young. We found adventure in everything we did. If it wasn't there already, we made it that way. I always enjoyed what I was doing and took a lot of satisfaction from it, and this has stayed with me. I live and farm there still. I left just after college and spent most of my life away. But I had to go home and make whatever contribution I could for what my community had given me in my younger days. Looking back on those days, I feel very fortunate to have been reared in a home where discipline, love, respect, and adherence to principles were the standards by which we were raised. The most powerful influence on me, without a doubt, was my father. He was tough, hard as the concrete he used to work, but fair and expected every person to pull his own weight. He was a man of high principles and required us kids to conform to them. Yet he was not rigid. He cared deeply for everyone in his family and wanted us all to be, in the words of the old Army ad line, all we could be. He would have made a good first sergeant. My father had few illusions. He never wanted us to follow in his footsteps and bend our backs to a lifetime of brutally tough construction and endless farm work. He understood what education would give us, though he himself only got through 8th grade. The older we grew, the harder he and my mother pressed us to get the best education we could. I will never forget his charge when he and my mom dropped me off at college. It was my first time there. I'd never visited the place before I was accepted. He said, "Boy, get an education or don't come back." His advice bore fruit. All but one of the children ended up with college degrees, and most went on for advanced degrees. There was another big education motivator in those days. Before the war, college was not in the cards for most young men from Appalachian Tennessee. But the post-war period saw GI Bill-trained doctors, lawyers, and other professionals bringing their expertise back to our eastern Tennessee communities. And this brought us all long-term benefits. Those who didn't seek college were still able to take advantage of the technical skills and training opportunities they had gained in the Army and other armed services to become skilled tradespeople, electricians, mechanics, plumbers, and the like. It was amazing to see how all this skill and expertise began to grow our community, and it wasn't hard to apply these lessons to ourselves. So my objective was to go directly into college after high school. I applied to 2 or 3, and all of them accepted me. In those days, we didn't have high school counselors to steer us, and in any case, I didn't know much except agriculture. At the same time, I was strongly aware of the obligation to serve my country after college, and felt it would be better to go in as a commissioned officer. For those reasons, I elected to go to Tennessee Polytechnic Institute, called Tennessee Tech, which was the only one of the 3 colleges I applied to that offered both a degree in agriculture and an ROTC program. Tennessee Tech was in Cookeville, Tennessee, 82 miles north of Nashville. Though Tech offered only Army ROTC, that was not a problem for me, since I never considered another service. I guess it was partly because of the influence of the boys I saw going off to the Army and fighting the war, and partly because I grew up outdoors in the country with lots of friends. The Army offered a continuation of that life, and truth was, I didn't know that much about the other services. On my graduation day, June 30th, 1958, I was commissioned a second lieutenant in the infantry. This was a reserve commission. I was offered a regular Army commission 2 years later. Though my mom and 2 of my brothers attended the graduation and commissioning ceremonies, there was no time for celebration because I had to report for active duty the same day. I set out within the hour for Fort Benning, near Columbus in southwestern Georgia, and drove without stopping, so I could report in before midnight without being AWOL. Fort Benning is a vast military base, primarily infantry, and called the home of the infantry. Housed there are the infantry school, the airborne school, the ranger school, the basic and the advanced officer courses, as well as officer candidate school. Many combat brigades were stationed at Benning, as was the 10th Mountain Division, which had just returned from Germany. I was initially assigned there as an assistant platoon leader. My first duties were as pit officer, running the targets up and down for a known distance rifle range, and officer in charge of a 106mm recoilless rifle range. And at least 2 afternoons a week, the officers taught general education subjects to the NCOs to help them get their high school GEDs. I loved the Army from day one, even though my jobs then weren't especially challenging and I hardly had much responsibility. I liked everything about it, the people, the structured environment, the training, the responsibility, and the opportunity for growth by using my own talents, capabilities, and initiative. After approximately 6 months, I took the basic officer's course, followed by jump school and ranger school. All were completed within 18 months. The basic course took up where the ROTC program left off. We mastered more advanced skills and developed technical competence in leadership, weapons, and tactical subjects that qualified us to lead an infantry platoon in combat operations. For example, We studied map reading in much greater detail than we had in ROTC. We learned how to effectively employ every weapon that was organic to a platoon. We learned patrolling and tactics at the platoon level, integration of fires, and how infantry should function with armor. My other big learning experience in those early days at Fort Benning was meeting Sue, who became my wife. She was 19, employed as a secretary, and enrolled in night classes at the Columbus Center of the University of Georgia. It also turned out she was the reigning Miss Georgia Air Reserve. Somebody else had obviously thought she was as good-looking as I did. From the beginning, I liked Sue a lot, and as I got to know her family, I liked them also. I'm not so sure that she thought as much of me as I did of her, but we started dating occasionally, and I continued to do my thing, soldiering as a young lieutenant. Meanwhile, I became friends with a service station owner named Kirby Smith, who also owned a pair of modified stock cars. Although he did not drive himself, Kirby sponsored his mechanic in stock car racing. I liked racing and would go with them on the weekends, and after a time, I started driving myself. I liked the racing, the challenge, the competition, the risk, and living on the edge. I guess I have always been that way, and the Army has afforded similar satisfaction in most of my assignments. Sue and I dated for 18 months, and in August 1959, we became engaged. 3 months later, we were married in her church, the Porter Memorial Baptist Church in Columbus, Georgia. Proposing to Sue, though, put an end to my racing career. When I popped the question, she gave me an ultimatum. "It's either your racing or me," she said. "You make the choice." Didn't take me long to sort out my priorities. As I look back over the 41 years of our marriage, Sue has proved the best companion and wife any man could ask for, my closest friend and toughest critic. She has been a role model mother, raising two outstanding daughters, while taking care of the family and wifely responsibilities in every command I held. Marrying her was the soundest decision I ever made. Jump and Ranger schools came after the basic course. For Steiner, jump school came almost immediately. He graduated from the basic course on Friday, had Saturday off, reported to jump school on Sunday, and started training on Monday morning. Parachute and ranger training are tough. Few people enjoy jumping out of airplanes. The risk is always there, rushing up at you. Parachutes don't always open, and even when they do open correctly, bones can break when a trooper lands. However, it's also not much fun to spend a couple of hard weeks in a swamp in summer, or in the mountains in winter with little or no sleep, having to live off the land when food is not available while conducting training as stressful and physically demanding as real combat. Ranger experience puts a soldier up against the absolute limits of mind and body. On the other hand, soldiers who successfully make it through these ordeals have a right to feel good about themselves. The best soldiers are usually airborne and ranger qualified, and airborne or ranger units are usually thought of as elite. All this notwithstanding, in the 1960s, every officer had to go through either jump or ranger school, and officers who expected to be assigned to a combat unit, whether infantry, armor, or artillery, had to go through both. The Army expected officers to be versatile. It wasn't enough to serve effectively in their own technical specialties. Officers had to have all the skills necessary to lead a unit in combat, and the broader perspective that gave. Even officers who weren't in combat branches, such as quartermaster, ordnance, or signal, were expected to handle specialized combat-oriented tasks and challenges. Every officer served at least 2 years in a combat unit before going to the branch in which he was commissioned, and to the basic officer qualification course in that branch. For those in non-combat branches, this was not only valuable experience in itself, but helped them later in serving and supporting the combat units. This is no longer the practice in the Army, partly because the shortage of officers has meant that the services can no longer afford the luxury, and partly because of the way the Army has evolved over time. Now, the Army is run the way business is, where most people are specialists. 40 years ago, everyone outside of the technical branches was seen as a generalist. The perception was that it didn't matter who you were on the battlefield. You were a better leader if you had a core of basic officer skills that enabled you to take care of your men under all circumstances. In most ways, today's army is a better prepared and more effective force than the army of 40 years ago. But the discontinuation of combat unit training and experience for all officers is a real loss. The objective of jump school has always been to teach a soldier how to put on his parachute and equipment properly, then how to exit an airplane, descend, and land safely. Mental alertness, confidence, and the ability to react automatically to just about anything that might happen during a jump are critical. The course normally took 4 weeks, but the Army was testing to see if compression could save training time and money without affecting performance. So for the 1958 class of infantry lieutenants, the course was compressed to 3 weeks. The instructors were all hand-picked NCOs, all master jumpers, and they were professional and tough. The program of instruction consisted of a ground week, tower week, and jump week, all punctuated with an extensive physical training program and a very stringent personal inspection each morning, especially during the first 2 weeks. Carl Steiner graduated from jump school on Saturday and reported into Ranger School the next morning. That afternoon, he and his companions received orientations and drew equipment. They began training at daylight Monday morning. Ranger School has two principal aims: to prepare small unit leaders for the missions and situations they are likely to face in combat, and to teach skills that are necessary for survival in enemy-held territory. It is the most physically demanding school in the Army for non-special operations soldiers. Though Ranger School is normally 9 weeks long, for Steiner it lasted 8 weeks, October to December 1958. Nothing was deleted but the sleep. It consisted of three phases: 2 weeks at Fort Benning, Georgia, 3 weeks in the Okefenokee Swamp at Eglin Air Force Base, Florida, and 3 weeks in the mountains at Dahlonega, Georgia. Carl Steiner explains, "Once a soldier has completed the Ranger course, he knows down to the tips of his fingers what his capabilities and limitations are. He has not only mastered the skills required of a small unit leader in combat, but he also has the confidence and skills necessary to survive there. I have always trusted a Ranger qualified officer or NCO to lead patrols for me in combat or any other tough situation because I knew he had the skills necessary to accomplish the mission and would take care of those entrusted to his leadership in the right way." These experiences do not only apply to junior officers, they become the essential underpinnings of competence through all the ranks and assignments of an Army career, particularly command. They give an understanding of a man's capabilities and limitations that comes in no other way, and they develop self-confidence in ways not otherwise possible. The basic objective of the Fort Benning phase was to learn the fundamentals of patrolling, the essentials of planning, operations orders, selecting primary and alternate routes, assembly areas, rallying points, passage of lines, actions at the objectives, and above all, the value of rehearsals. You did it over and over until you got it right. The first 2 weeks were focused on heavy-duty physical training, log drills, endurance runs, hand-to-hand combat, the bayonet assault course, and the obstacle course. We also did a lot of rope work, learning the different knots and how to build different kinds of rope bridges. And we did a lot of rope climbing. There were two objectives here: to learn the different ways to climb a rope and to build upper body strength. Another important element was advanced land navigation. Soldiers have to be expert navigators to be able to get to where they're going and when they're not familiar with the territory, and they have to do it quickly under the worst circumstances. Nowadays, we have global positioning systems to make navigating easier, and these do give us an enormous advantage. But there is no substitute for a map in the hands of a good map reader and a compass in the hands of a good navigator. If you have these, and if all the electronic wizardry fails, you still have all you need to find out where you are and to keep you on course. Finally, we were taught every fundamental about patrolling: the different kinds of patrols, reconnaissance, combat, raids, ambushes, etc., the organizations of each type of patrol, the patrol order, selecting routes, actions at danger areas, and action upon reaching the objective. During the Benning phase, we rehearsed many times over our patrolling techniques. The Florida phase of our training came next. We left Fort Benning early on a Saturday morning in October on buses headed to the Florida Ranger camp on Eglin Air Force Base. Few of us remembered much about the trip, which took most of the day, because we slept as much as we could. Near the Florida state line, a member of the Ranger cadre woke us up to put us in the right frame of mind. He read us a general situation. "The United States is at war," he told us, "and we have entered a mythical country. I've forgotten its name, as a replacement unit." When we reached our Florida destination, our accommodations were austere. Tents that accommodated 24 men each, canvas cots, no floors, a World War II-type mess hall, a small arms room, and a small aid station manned by a single medic. About half an hour after we arrived, we were given an alert order to be prepared to move out within 2 hours on our first reconnaissance patrol. Our mission? To reconnoiter a possible enemy missile site. When we moved out, we moved directly into the swamps, into water up to our waists. We were there for the next 3 days and nights. This turned out to be the norm for the entire training. Constant patrolling, constant raids, constant ambushes, and always wet and cold. You don't normally think of Florida as cold, but in October, that's what it can get if you are constantly wet, even in Florida. As a part of the Florida phase, we were given special instructions on survival, how to catch and prepare food, what to eat and what not to eat, which wild plants and berries were safe, which weren't. And we were given chickens, rabbits, alligators, opossums, raccoons, and snakes that we had to prepare for some day's feast. Another challenge was the confidence course, an inverted crawl on ropes hanging 40 feet above murky, over-our-heads water with explosives in the water going off constantly. At some point on the rope, we'd be told to drop into the water and swim to dry land about 100 feet away, with the explosives still going off. During the 3 weeks, we only saw base camp, our tent, and the mess hall about 4 or 5 times. At other times, we ate food provided by partisans. That is, if we linked up with them at the designated place and time. We didn't always do that, and it was usually live chickens, rabbits, or even a goat. We didn't get much sleep either. I was one of the designated sleep keepers. That meant I had to keep a record of whatever sleep I was able to get that was more than 30 minutes. As I recall, at the end of 17 days, my records indicated it totaled 8 hours and 10 minutes. When the 3 weeks were over, most of us who'd started were still hanging in and looking forward to the next phase, though some had been eliminated, for attitude, lack of motivation, physical failure, or whatever. The mountain phase was next. We came in from our last patrol in Florida at mid-afternoon on a Saturday, finished our patrol debriefings, and began to clean and turn in the weapons and equipment that would remain at the campsite. After a big meal in the mess hall, we hit the sack somewhere around midnight, dry for a change, for much-needed sleep. At about 0300 Sunday morning, the Ranger cadre came running through the camp yelling, "Formation in 10 minutes! Fall out with all your gear, prepared to move out!" We jumped out of the sack, having slept in our fatigues, quickly put on our dry pair of boots, rolled up our sleeping bags, which stayed with the cot, put on our Ranger web gear, harness, and fell in at our appointed place in a company formation. The camp commander, a major, positioned himself before the formation and announced, "There has been a major enemy breakthrough in the northern part of the operational area. You are to move out immediately as much-needed reinforcements in that sector of the combat zone." Buses arrived 10 minutes later, and we set out for northern Georgia. I don't remember much about that trip, because we slept most of the way. At about 1600 hours, the buses pulled off the highway where a gravel road ran off into the woods, and several empty 2.5-ton trucks were parked. A Ranger captain was standing in the middle of the road. As soon as we dismounted and formed up in front of him, he advised that it was not safe to take the buses any farther because of enemy infiltration teams in the area. We would have to take the trucks. He also indicated that the beds of the trucks had been sandbagged and that we should be prepared for ambush. Since we didn't have any weapons, we were glad to see 2 armed guards with each truck. Even though we didn't have our individual weapons, we had rehearsed counter-ambush drills from a truck or convoy many times, so we knew what to do.
We had probably gone no more than 5 miles until we were ambushed by a platoon of dug-in enemy. Of course, it was all explosives and blank fire, but they really shot us up good. We quickly dismounted and dived in a ditch alongside the road. When the smoke had cleared, we were assembled back on the road and told that our trucks had been destroyed and that we would have to run the rest of the way, about 5 miles and mostly uphill. At the base camp, it was in a beautiful spot as it happened. We were fed a great evening meal, all we could eat. Then we drew our weapons and individual equipment and squared away our sleeping tents. As in Florida, we wouldn't see much of them for the next 3 weeks. The next morning started with rappelling instruction. First, we learned how to tie every knot needed for ranger-type operations. Then we trained in rappelling until we'd mastered all the rappelling techniques, first on the lower cliffs, 30 to 50 feet, and then on higher ones, 60 to 80 feet. Finally, we were required to rappel with our ranger buddy hanging on our back. After the rock work, there was instruction in the mountain adaptations to already learned skills, such as land navigation, wilderness survival, and operational survival. Then came instruction on wilderness survival. In the mountains, the snakes are different than the ones in Florida. Copperheads and rattlesnakes rather than water moccasins and coral snakes. And in the mountains, you don't find the same edible plants and berries that you do in the swamps. We also got instruction on avoiding detection. We were taught to stay away from danger areas such as roads and built-up areas, towns, houses, etc., and how to cross danger areas, open fields and roads without being observed. We also patrolled day and night just in Florida, but the rough terrain and heavy loads, like machine guns, some patrol members had to carry made a big difference, requiring more careful planning of patrol routes and more time for reaching the objective. As was the case throughout the entire Ranger instruction program, every patrol had to be planned and rehearsed in every detail to ensure that it would go right, and every student had to know every detail of the plan. Although a patrol leader and assistant patrol leader were designated in advance, you never knew when you may be called on to be the patrol leader, most usually in the most demanding situations, such as the middle of a firefight. A member of the Ranger cadre, called a lane grader, accompanied every patrol. This was usually a first lieutenant or a senior NCO, but sometimes both, depending on the size of the patrol. Their job was to evaluate the performance of every member of the patrol and to be present in case of an emergency or life-threatening situation. Meanwhile, the aggressors, the bad guys, were all over the place, knew the terrain better than we did, and had co-opted most of the civilians that lived in the area, which meant we could not trust anyone. The weather became a major factor in early December as the temperature dropped rapidly and the snow began to fall. Our last patrol was a long-range combat patrol to stimulate the blow-up of the Tocoa Dam, which was about 50 or 60 miles from our base area. Bad weather delayed the completion of our mission a couple of days, but then the helicopters came for us. We could hear the roar as they approached. Then snow was blowing everywhere as they set down, the most beautiful sight I had seen in 7 weeks. We flew back to the Ranger base camp at Dahlonega, where we were met by quite a reception. The Ranger Department Commander, a colonel, was there, along with a team of doctors and a chaplain. The docs checked us all, but found nothing major. There was a little frostbite, ears, fingers, and toes. Next came a hot meal, all we could eat. Then we were put on the buses and sent back to Fort Benning. The next morning, we had a company formation to find out who had earned the Ranger tab. No guests were invited. When your name was called, you stepped forward. When the calling was done, approximately 20 men were left behind who'd gone all the way through the training, but for some reason had failed to earn the tab. I felt sorry for them, but that's the way it is. The standard has to be met. Carl Steiner has always been known in the Army as an expert trainer, and many of his Army assignments directly involve training. Here are some of his thoughts on that experience. Early in my career, I realized that military training offers a unique opportunity, not only for preparing men for combat, but for preparing them for the most important of life's values, personal attributes, principles,
ethics, motivation for the right reasons, love of country, and self-respect. In other words, the values that should be manifested in every citizen of our great nation. In my judgment, training is the essential element for the readiness of any unit in any service. The very best equipment is great to have, and I'll never turn any down, but well-trained people win wars. Here are a few training principles that I have tried to live by. A commander should always have his unit ready to go to war without any required train-up period. If he has been given the resources he needs, there's no reason why his unit should not be ready at all times. If some reason is beyond his control, he should have identified it a long while back and brought it to the attention of his commanders, so something could be done about the problem. A commander must be in the field personally, supervising and evaluating training. Otherwise, he will never know the true status of training readiness of his unit and how to structure future training for correcting both unit and individual weaknesses. Time is a commander's most crucial asset, and it should never be wasted, not a single minute. If a unit fails to meet the standard for a given training event, then the commander should adjust the schedule to keep the unit in the field until they get it right, no matter how long it takes. Don't ever say, "We'll correct the deficiency next time out." There may not be a next time before they are committed to battle. The responsible commander, brigade, battalion, should never be satisfied with just meeting the standard. He should keep raising the bar with an ultimate goal of maximizing the technical and tactical proficiency of every individual. Cross-training between skills is also very important, especially within crews of crew-served weapons that are vital to unit effectiveness in combat. Replacements are not always readily available on the battlefield. Nothing I have said is new to any successful commander. We have lived by these principles and tenets in fulfilling our responsibilities for preparing those entrusted to us, the cream of America's youth, for success in battle. This responsibility is a sacred trust, directed not only toward success in battle, but also to the lives of the men and women we command. This includes bringing them safely back to their families and having them feel good about themselves for what they have done for our nation. Soldiers will unhesitatingly lay their lives on the line because of this trust in their commander and their fellow soldiers. They have no one else to look to. This means, finally, that a commander's unit, no matter what kind it is, will be only as good as he is, a direct reflection of his principles and values, and of his dedication, his motivation, and his love and respect for his troops. A commander must therefore give it whatever it takes. No one else will do it for him. During most of my Army career, I have been fortunate to serve in combat units where training and preparedness for no-notice contingency operations were an imperative. And for having had this opportunity, I indeed feel privileged. Few are called, fewer are chosen. After completing the advanced infantry course at Fort Benning, Georgia, Captain Carl Steiner was assigned to Fort Jackson, South Carolina. He had served there for 16 months when, one Saturday afternoon in September 1964, he received classified orders that the post was moving him and his family that weekend. The reassignment was to Fort Bragg, North Carolina. He had a building number where he was supposed to report, but the MOS, Military Occupation Specialty, was classified. Steiner had no idea what he was about to get into, but whatever it was, the Army had told him to move. So that afternoon, he and his wife, Sue, began to get themselves and their infant daughter, Carla, ready. The next day, they checked into a rental trailer near Fort Bragg, since no quarters were available. And on Monday, Steiner reported in at the building he'd been given. When he showed up, a line of maybe 50 officers, most of them captains, but also a few first lieutenants, was there, all of them in the same boat. They had all been pulled in on short notice, and none of them had any idea what was going on. When Steiner was called into Special Forces, he knew very little about who they were or what they did. Their secretive, closed nature extended to the rest of the Army. He did know the Special Forces were highly selective and highly trained, and that as Army units went, they were small. In 1964, approximately 17,700 people, including PSYOPs and civil affairs. And he knew they were unconventional in their thinking, their organization, and their mission. Even their headgear was unorthodox, green berets. The rest he would have to find out as he went along. At the lineup, Steiner was assigned to A Company of the recently activated, because of the Vietnam buildup, 3rd Special Forces Group, and told to check in with the Company XO, a diminutive major by the name of LeBlanc. When Steiner walked smartly into LeBlanc's office, the major looked up and frowned. Steiner was wearing the standard flat-topped green service hat with a bill, and the XO wasn't pleased. "That will never do," he announced, "but I'll get you straightened out. Go down to the supply room and draw you 2 berets. Understand you're not authorized to wear the flash yet." The flash was his unit colors, and showed he was a real green beret. "But you can wear the chocolate bar," a little bar that represented the colors of what would be in the big flash when he earned it. "You'll wear that until you are prefix 3 qualified," which meant he had successfully passed the Special Forces qualifying course, called Q Course. This normally took 10 weeks. From there, the XO got down to the real business at hand. "What you're here for is, you're going to be an A detachment commander." In 1964, the Special Forces mission was primarily focused on unconventional warfare, UW, and the chief threat was Soviet expansion in Europe. The entire Special Forces 10th Group was stationed in Europe, and money, weapons, and supplies had been hidden in Eastern Europe and in the parts of Western Europe that might be overrun by the Soviets. In the event of a Warsaw Pact invasion, aid detachments could be dropped behind the lines, or else hide and reappear after having been passed over by invading forces, then link up with friendly guerrillas and partisans. Their mission? Sabotage, subversion, and organizing and equipping resistance movements. All of this required a high level of independence, analysis, and decision-making. The Leadership Reaction Course was one of the ways they trained and tested for these qualities. It emphasized teamwork, imagination, resourcefulness, ingenuity, and, of course, leadership, and started with a physically and intellectually difficult puzzle. For instance, imagine a moat in which the water is 8 or 10 feet deep and the distance from one bank to the other is 12 feet. A team in training is provided with a 55-gallon drum of gasoline and 3 pieces of timber, 2 of them 10 feet long, and the third 8 feet. The team's job is to get the barrel and themselves across the moat using the materials provided. If the team has what it takes to become Special Forces soldiers, they'll work out a way to do it. Another method of training was by sensory deprivation. Operating on their own, behind the lines in enemy territory, puts extraordinary demands on soldiers. One of the most difficult of these is the absence of emotional support. Friendships, trust, and confidence belong to a soldier's makeup as much as obedience, and readily available support provides a powerful counterbalance to the uncertainty in a soldier's life. Many excellent soldiers stay up to speed primarily because they are praised. They need the certainty that comes from knowing somebody above them considers them to be a good and solid performer. That is not the case with Special Forces soldiers, who must operate in environments in which every kind of support is minimal, absent, or transitory. Some soldiers have the spirit and will to handle that situation, but many others don't. The Special Forces Sensory Deprivation Training Program is designed to find out who has what it takes. Soldiers are not told the goals or the standards they are expected to reach, or whether they're doing well or badly. A soldier might be told one day, "You show up at this road junction at 0600 hours in the morning with your rucksack." When he arrives, an NCO will be waiting with a piece of paper that contains his next instructions, which might be, "You are to move from this point to this point. Say 25 miles. And then he's left on his own, with no help other than a map and a compass. No idea of how long he has to get from point to point. When or if he shows up at the appointed location, his presence is simply acknowledged. He is not told whether he passed or failed, or if he made the journey in the correct time. Success in this exercise comes not only from accomplishing a difficult task, but from doing it totally out of his own internal resources. Much of Special Forces training is conducted according to similar rules. In the meantime, the Special Forces soldier must also train for specific skills. As previously noted in an aid detachment, soldiers not only have to handle their own specialty, but be prepared to handle everyone else's. When Steiner met the aid detachment that he was to command for the next 8 months, he was impressed. The members of his detachment were all professional Special Forces soldiers with considerable experience. Most were years older than Steiner, and maybe half were Lodge Act volunteers, originally from Eastern European countries. They were already proficient in unconventional and covert warfare and spoke one or two other languages. At the same time, they were more or less new to one another, having been reassigned within the Special Forces following the forming of the Third Group, and so had not trained together as an aid detachment. During the week Steiner was taking the Q course, his aid detachment was learning what it needed to know to function as a group. In the 60s, everyone in an aid detachment was trained in the following skills. Each soldier had to be an expert marksman on his individual weapon, a pistol, and his M16 rifle, and be familiar with weapons such as AK-47s that he might encounter in the part of the world in which he might be employed. Each soldier was trained in explosives. He learned the kind of charge, the shape, and the placement for bringing down bridges or power lines, for cratering charges or breaching, for getting inside a sealed and defended building with the minimum damage to the structure or to the hostages who may be inside. If he had no explosives of his own, he was taught how to obtain what he needed to make them from local sources. Each soldier received communications training, sending and receiving Morse code and code writing. Each soldier received advanced first aid training. Each soldier learned how to conduct clandestine and covert operations, how to establish intelligence nets and escape evasion nets, how to conduct resupply operations at night, how to set up a field for landing airplanes and bring them in, and how to set up parachute drop zones. He learned clandestine infiltration and exfiltration techniques, land navigation, and special or deep reconnaissance, in which he would operate in total stealth in order to put eyes directly on anything an enemy might not want him to see. Often this meant living for days in hide sites, holes in the ground a team would dig and then cover over with dirt, branches, or other concealment. Each soldier was provided with a working knowledge of the principal language in his group's area of focus. German, say, for members of the 10th Group in Europe, or Swahili for the 3rd Group. Later, language proficiency was increased enormously, and Special Forces soldiers were expected to devote as long as 6 months or a year, full time, to attaining fluency in their language. In 1964, fluency was not required, but soldiers were expected to communicate in a simple and rudimentary way. Similarly, each soldier was provided with cultural training, as appropriate, so that when he went into a country, he knew how to behave in ways that would win friends and not alienate the people he was there to help, and thus harm the mission. Finally, although each aid detachment commander had an operations sergeant and a weapons sergeant, it was an officer's responsibility to know indirect fire support, artillery fire, and mortar fire, and how to employ it most accurately and effectively. He had to know how to plan defensive fires, or call in air or naval gunfire if these ever became necessary.